Karina, how are you? Never been better in your entire life? Totally never been better. Daisy, you're late again. Oh, my God. What were you doing there? I heard all of you had a very, very productive and interesting discussion yesterday. Hannah's skeptical, as always. You ready, Jordan? No notes being passed between you and Daisy? You know, if you do, we got to share them. You know how that goes, right? Couple announcements. Please get your PTEs from Jessica. Email her or she'll email you back. I think she just got those numbers for the lab for next quarter. And we're going to have an introductory meeting sometime next week. And those of you that are going to adventure in this very exciting opportunity, and it's going to be a lot of fun, I'll email you and let you know when that meeting's going to be. Tuesday, we're going to talk about Science and the Constitution, Part 2, and go into all of these fascinating things about patenting and patenting life and everything else associated with that. A week from yesterday, we're going to have a discussion. And the discussion, hi, Kyle. The discussion's going to be, just getting out of physics lab. The discussion's going to be on cancer and cancer genes. And please, we need Daisy's name tag. And Jordan's. Jordan's got one. And Chris. Yeah, great. Just for today. Anyways, next Wednesday's discussion is going to be on cancer and cancer genes. We talked a little bit about that, and I'm going to, it's going to be an exciting discussion because cancer is something which we've talked about in here, which is a subject of something that affects all of us in many different ways. And Sam, are you okay today? And so these articles will tell you about the conceptual basis of cancer. David, you got a haircut, and maybe I should do my hair like that too, huh? Maybe a buzz cut or something. Right, exactly. Anyways, pick up the articles at the end of class. I have to announce that a week from today, your take-home test is due at 3:30, at exactly 3:30, not a minute late. And the minute your take-home exam is handed in, we'll have your oral exam to follow. Does anyone have any questions about the take-home test? Not questions on the questions, but anything related to anything. Anton, you're happy? Melissa, you're happy? Jessica, you're happy? Great, so am I. Okay, following today's very, very special guest speaker, there's going to be a reception outside with a menu that all of you will be very happy with. And then those of you that are going to dinner, be Melissa and Brian, you, Daisy, Chris, and Becca will be meeting and will be going down into Westwood for dinner. And doing away with the pianist in the faculty center. Which brings me to the main event of today. You know, it's really a very, 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 very special thing, as I mentioned to you on Tuesday, when one of one's former students can come back and give a lecture in class. And it's a really tremendous honor because I've always believed, and I'll always, always believe, that there's really no greater compliment that a professor can ever get is when the student becomes the teacher. And certainly Dr. Evans has taught me quite a lot, particularly about reproduction and fertility and in vitro fertilization and a lot of other things. I went through a little bit of Michelle's background on Tuesday, but I'm just going to say that it was about 17 years ago that she was doing exactly the same thing that you were doing and worrying about getting her midterm take-home exam in what would be now called Life Sciences 3, which was then called Biology 7. And I first met Michelle when, about a year later, I think, after you were in my class, you came into my office, nervous, I think, at the time, asking me for a recommendation for medical school, as I recall. And I said, well, I knew you from class, but I didn't really know you very well. In order to write a recommendation, I need to know students well. And I said, do you go running? And she said, yeah, I run. And it started a 17-year-long friendship, because during the last year that Michelle was at UCLA, we spent a few times doing double perimeters, as I recall, and single perimeters, and just talking about the future and medical school and all of those other things. And then Dr. Evans went off to medical school and graduated from Loma Linda Medical School, and graduated and got many, 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 many awards and honors, of which I'm not going to go into, but the story is told that at her graduation, every time someone said, and the next award for, it was always then Michelle Evans, and then the next award for, and it was always Michelle Evans. Yeah, I knew you'd shake your head. In any case, she went off to medical school and graduated from medical school, and then went on to a residency in obstetrics and gynecology. So that's 4 years of an undergraduate degree. Graduate, obviously, of UCLA, 4 years of medical school, 4 years of a residency. Became board certified in obstetrics and gynecology, which means you have to pass rigorous exams, both written and oral. And then went into private practice, as I told you. And then decided to specialize in reproductive endocrinology, which is the field at which individuals, as she will tell you, do in vitro fertilization and a variety of other things related to fertility. And after 2 years in private practice, went back and got a very prestigious fellowship at UCSF, University of California, San Francisco. Did 3 years of a fellowship and graduated from that fellowship as a individual who specializes as a reproductive endocrinologist. Now, I'm not going to go into, as I already told you on Tuesday, all the remarkable things about Dr. Evans, but as I told you, she's a remarkable role model and a remarkable mentor. And I can also say that she's doing this specially for us, that it's not something that she does all the time. And if you heard her schedule, it would leave you absolutely breathless between getting up in the morning and taking your kids to school and picking them up and giving them lunch and spending 4 hours then in an operating room and coming back and taking them to baseball practice and then preparing for her patients in the morning. And she's just a remarkable, remarkable individual. So Dr. Evans is going to talk to us today about fertility, in vitro fertilization, and genetic testing. That's the website from www.havingbabies.com, and her email is michelle.evans@gmail.com if you have any questions. And let's give a very, very, very warm reception to one of our own fellow Bruin, Dr. Michelle Evans. Let me get this on for you. There we go.
Can you hear me?
Got it.
Got it.
Testing.
Thank you.
Let me know if you need anything.
I'm embarrassed, actually. About
you
that.
Are?
Yeah.
You want to go to the board and design an experiment?
No. I had to do that already.
Unambiguously?
I was thinking that as I was driving here that most of you were probably like in toddlers and diapers when I was in this class, actually, 17 years ago. And I'm really honored to be back here because this was a very different kind of class for me. I was just sort of your typical pre-med student here at UCLA in huge classes, and this was the first class where somebody, I think, knew who I was, actually, and that's why I could go back when I was done and ask for a recommendation. I was still scared, but I thought, you know, he'll probably remember me because he had your pictures and would have you come up and design experiments and all of that. And I feel honored because he, you know, Dr. Goldberg, I would say, is my best professor I've ever had, going through undergrad, medical school, residency, fellowship, and all of that, because of the time and effort and creativity and all of that that he does. So I'm really happy to be here. And when I went and asked for a medical school recommendation, I didn't really run. I just made that up. But I wanted to, you know, get to know him and get this recommendation. And we have actually still run sometimes together, if you can drag me out there. I'm here to talk to you. I talked last year for the first time, and typically I don't do things like this. Usually I sit in an office and I talk to one person or a couple about infertility, and so it's not something I'm used to doing, so bear with me. And if you have any questions along the way, feel free to ask at any time. You don't have to wait till the end. Last year, what I did was I actually started off with an infertility consultation to show you basically what I do every day when patients come in who are trying to have a pregnancy. And last year, I chose two students randomly to come up, and I'm not going to do that because I remember being a student in this class, and I didn't like that. So I'm actually going to ask TAs. So you guys probably want to be together.
Okay.
Okay.
I know. There's only one chair, so.
Do you want to?
You can sit.
So this is I'm just going to ask them questions, exactly the same questions that I ask to couples who come in to see me, see what kind of answers they have, and be honest. And then I just want you to notice, you know, what they're talking about and the answers that they have and see if there's anything that stands out to you, maybe that are red flags or things that you would worry about if you were a reproductive endocrinologist. Okay? All right. So come on into the office. Hi. Gloria. Hi. I'm Dr. Evans. How are you?
Nice to meet you, Dr.
Evans. Hi. So why are you two here today?
Well.
You dragged me down here.
Do you want to have a baby?
We've been trying, yes. We've been trying for about a year now. And nothing's working.
Okay. Well, let's get a little bit of history. You guys have been together for how long?
Four or five years.
Four years.
And were you using contraception originally?
What
were you using?
I was on birth control.
Okay. So you stopped about a year ago?
Yes.
Okay. And since that time, you've been... timing intercourse, or what have you been doing?
Well,
it's kind of dropped off a bit lately. Once a week.
We used to have it about 3 or 4 times a week, and now it's just once a week. And it's timed around my, you know, my cycle, and it's become a job, pretty much.
Have you been using ovulation kits?
We tried those, and nothing was working.
Do you think the stress of all of this has caused you to have intercourse less frequently?
Well, I'm a busy guy. I'll be honest about that. I work out at the gym every day. My body's important to me. I ride the bike on the weekend. I go out. And sometimes I'm tired. I'm not in the mood for it. Now, what can I do about that?
Okay.
He says he's not in the mood for it, right? He says he goes to the gym.
You know, maybe if she had more energy, I'd be into it.
I don't think so.
Maybe if you weren't, you know, so such a bitch all the time.
Oh! Well, maybe if you pay attention to me more...
Just calm down.
You know, this is only an hour consultation, actually, so maybe we should move on. Gloria, let me start with you. How old are you?
I'm 21.
And have you ever had a pregnancy before?
Once.
Wait, what?
It was a long time ago. I was young.
You said you were a virgin.
It was a mistake.
Well, what happened?
What did you do?
I had an abortion.
And how old were you?
I was 17.
Were there any problems with that procedure? What happened?
I got an infection afterwards, and I was on antibiotics.
Okay. Any problems now?
Not really.
Okay.
My period's a little lighter than usual. I skip once in a while.
Okay.
Right.
So how old were you when you first had a period?
I was 12.
And did you have regular periods up until the time of this abortion?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And so now you skip sometimes, they're lighter?
Right.
Okay.
Right, they're lighter.
Do you have pain?
No pain.
Okay, do you bleed in between periods?
No, not at all.
Okay. Do you have any signs that let you know a period's going to come?
Not usually. Maybe some, you know, some back aches once in a while.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And do you have any history of sexually transmitted infections?
Oh, please tell me. Sweetie.
I had chlamydia.
Okay, and so chlamydia.
Yes.
Okay. And how was that treated? And?
And? Genital warts.
And genital warts. Okay. Genital warts and chlamydia. Anything else?
No.
Okay. How was the chlamydia treated?
With antibiotics.
Okay. And did you have
treated.
Did you have any treatment for the warts?
Yes.
Okay.
They were removed.
Perfect. Perfect. Do you have any leakage of milk from the breasts?
No.
Do you have any hair growth on your face or chest?
No, not that I know of. I don't know, do I, honey? No, no.
I think she's good.
Do you have any medical problems that you see a doctor for regularly?
No.
And have you had surgery before besides the abortion? Do you take any medicines?
I take vitamin supplements.
Prenatal vitamins?
That's right.
Okay. And do you have allergies to medicines?
No, I don't.
And do you smoke?
I don't.
Do you drink alcohol?
Once a day, yes.
What do you drink?
It depends. Usually just a glass of wine. Don't judge.
And do you smoke? Do you drink caffeine?
Yes.
How much?
Usually 3 cups of coffee or a Diet Coke a day.
Okay.
I like our caffeine.
And mm-hmm. then tell me about your family history. Are there diseases that run in your family?
My father has diabetes. Mm-hmm. And no other diseases, but one of my aunts went through menopause when she was about 30, actually.
Okay.
And my mother has a regular cycle.
She had a regular cycle.
Right.
Okay. Is there any mental retardation in your family?
Nope.
Any breast cancer?
Mm-mm.
Ovarian or uterine cancer?
Nope, none.
Okay, Mike, let's move on to you.
Yeah, let's move on to you.
Yeah, okay.
How old are you?
I'm 21.
And have you had any pregnancies or children with anybody?
There was a couple.
A couple?
One of them, I was young. When I was 17, I had a kid. Okay. And he's doing well right now.
You had a kid?
Yeah,
he's... You never told me you had a kid.
Well, I didn't think it was important.
Oh,
it's not
God,
your
no,
kid.
We're married. Why does... have another kid in you.
So I have a kid. I'm sorry that she's being immature about this. I
guess. Oh!
And there was also a miscarriage when I was a bit younger, so...
Okay.
I had a couple.
Okay.
I think my boys can swim.
Okay. Were these unplanned?
Yeah, I'm not always the straightest thinker.
So, you're responsible.
I was young, man. I was young.
Tell me what kind of work you do.
What kind of work? So I work in this lab. I'm a graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
Work with DNA, a lot of, some chemicals, that kind of stuff.
Okay, so you have toxic exposures at work, you think?
Or I try not to spill stuff on myself, but I get kind of clumsy sometimes and, a couple times maybe.
Okay. Do you have medical problems at all?
I'm bipolar. That's
okay.
About it.
Okay. Do you take medication for that?
Yeah, lithium.
Okay. And is that well controlled?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm pretty good.
Okay.
I'm pretty good, right?
Any other medicines?
No. That's about it.
Have you had surgery?
No. Well, when I was like 2, I had a hernia. Then I had a surgery for
hernia
that.
Hernia repair. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And do you have allergies to medicines at all?
No, none.
Do you smoke or chew tobacco?
I like chewing tobacco on occasion when I go out to play softball with the boys. It makes you feel like a big leaguer.
Yeah.
So.
How often do you do that?
Not that often. Maybe every couple weeks here and there.
Okay. And do you drink alcohol?
Yeah. I like to party sometimes. So.
Understatement.
So do you drink daily or do you drink on the weekends?
No, usually more,
or?
Yeah, more the kind of the college student kind of drinking sessions where it's just, on the weekends.
Do you, how much can you drink in a weekend day?
Oh, how much can't I drink, Michelle?
Okay, so could you drink maybe a 6-pack or a 12-pack or
oh,
something?
Yeah.
Okay,
oh, yeah.
All right. And then how about caffeine?
Love it. I love espressos. Can't get enough of them.
How many do you have a day?
Between maybe 5, 6,
okay.
Usually. Some, 3 in the morning, then some more in the afternoon.
Okay.
Keep me going.
And how about any drug use, either of you?
No. No drug use.
Any drug use? Marijuana?
I'm clean.
Okay.
I'm clean.
And how about your family history? Anything that runs in your family?
I have a brother and a sister. They both have Down syndrome.
Okay.
You
so
never told me that. You never told me.
Are you judging
that.
Them because of that?
No.
Yeah, okay, that's what I thought.
Okay. Do you have any siblings without Down syndrome?
No, just those two.
Okay. Any other diseases or things that run in your family?
That's about it.
Okay. And do you exercise? You said you did.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
I go to the gym, go to the sauna, and I go in the spa with me and the boys.
Yeah?
Pretty much every day of the week. I ride the
every
bike
every day
on
in the
weekend.
spa.
There's some hills over by campus I like.
How much do you ride your bike?
Maybe about 30 miles on the average.
Okay.
There.
Okay. Have you ever had a semen analysis done?
No, can't say I have.
Okay.
It's his fault. You know it's his fault.
Have you had any kind of workup, blood work or anything, either of you? Okay. So what we'll do from here is we'll order some blood tests. We'll order a semen analysis. And we'll order a test to look at your uterus and your tubes, fallopian tubes, and we'll take a look at your ovaries today with ultrasound, okay? And give you a better idea about what's going on. Do you have any questions?
I think that sounds good. We'll try it.
Yeah, this might work after
this,
all.
This really was an enlightening experience.
Thank you. All right. So is there anything in that history that stands out to you? Do you think I should be concerned about anything? Yeah.
Maybe the fact that she had an infection after the abortion.
Okay, right. That's right. So she had an infection after her abortion, and what that can lead to is something called Asherman syndrome, which is basically scarring inside the uterus. That can change your menstrual cycles, and it can also cause a sort of a hostile environment in your uterus where an embryo can't implant. Doesn't usually happen. I mean, typically if someone has a termination like that, everything goes smoothly. They don't have infections, but when people have a complication, that really stands out. Yeah. Right.
Microphone.
So she says chlamydia. Can't chlamydia cause infertility? Chlamydia is a very common sexually transmitted infection. And the problem with chlamydia, the big problem, is that in 80% of women who have it, there's no symptoms. And in 50% of men, there's no symptoms. So sometimes the first time that someone knows that they have chlamydia is when they come to me, been trying to get pregnant, I do an x-ray of their tubes, and the tubes are blocked. Because that's what chlamydia can do, is to block the tubes. Anything else? Jordan?
He said he rides his bike like 30 miles a day.
Right. So that's a big deal. Anything that heats up the testicles can cause problems with sperm production or the sperm count. So he did a couple of things. He does saunas and hot tubs daily. And he does this bike riding. And bike riding, a lot of exercise is fine, but bike riding is sort of one of those big ones that stands out because it... people can get very hot, and then there's also sort of the pounding on the bike, and that makes a difference. So that's right.
Heather.
Gloria was saying.
This one's not working.
Is it? Okay. Gloria was saying that after her abortion, her menstrual cycles had thinned and were skipping sometimes?
Right, so they change. So either in that, it could be different things. It could be a result of that complication that she had, like we talked about, or maybe her hormones are changing. She had an aunt, remember, who went through menopause at 30, and that's called premature ovarian failure, and that can be genetic. So that's a possibility for her, too. Maybe things are changing. Maybe she's heading toward menopause at an early age.
Does lithium cause any kind of side effects?
Actually, it's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, Betty.
Hey.
The fact that they're both heavy caffeine users, does that cause like hormone imbalance?
It actually can cause problems in the man. And when you get to about 5 cups or more of coffee a day, you can see changes in sperm.
I was just going to point out the alcohol consumption.
Right.
That would probably have a big factor into both.
Right. Actually, Gloria's really, it probably wouldn't. Drinking daily, like a glass of wine or something daily, actually doesn't affect it, but it's that binge type of drinking that affects fertility. Typically in the man, it affects the fertility doing that sort of weekend drinking if you're not having anything during the week and then you drink a lot. The thing that's good for about a man is that the sperm is cycled, and about every 69 days you have a whole new crop. And so if you did all this binge drinking and everything, you know, about 70 days later, it's out of your system, everything's sort of back to normal. The alcohol use for her could be an issue when she gets pregnant because of fetal alcohol syndrome.
Yeah. Could the fact that two of my brothers or siblings had Down syndrome?
Right, that's important. I mean, Down syndrome is fairly common. And increases as a woman's age increases, as the mom increase, you know, as her age increases, the risk of Down syndrome increases. But having two siblings, it's pretty rare to have something like that happen twice. So you have to worry that maybe one of the parents has something called a balanced translocation, and maybe they're passing on that extra 21 chromosome. And so that might be something that they want to look into to see if Mike carries a balanced translocation before they have their child. And if he does, maybe they would want to do special testing to assure that they have a child without Down syndrome, right? Jordan?
What about the tobacco, like the chewing tobacco?
That's a big thing. Tobacco is huge. Cigarettes or chewing tobacco causes significant abnormalities in sperm count, motility, and morphology, which is the way the sperm looks.
What about like marijuana?
Yes, both. But again, remember that you can clear up that problem by stopping and waiting a few months. It's not permanent. Daisy?
Does that do anything to a woman and her reproductive ability to smoke anything?
There was actually a study that just came out. I mean, I used to say, oh, it probably does, but I didn't have anything to back it up. About 3 or 4 months ago, a study came out looking at three groups of women. One group were non-smokers, one were women exposed to secondhand smoke, and the third group were smokers. And these were women going through in vitro fertilization to have pregnancies. The groups that were the smokers and the women exposed to secondhand smoke actually had a 50% decreased pregnancy rate compared to the non-smokers. So yeah, so finally there's a study, good, that's out there so that, you know, we can quote to people who come in. That they need to stop and their partner needs to stop and they really need to not be around people who are smoking like that when they're trying to get pregnant. Anything else? So that was good. I think you hit most of the things on that. We'll go over a lot of these things. So I'm going to talk to you about infertility, in vitro fertilization, which is also called IVF, and then genetic testing. And I'm going to talk to you about infertility in general and go over the different causes of infertility. And some of it's going to be real basic things that I'm going to review. And then I'm going to talk about treatment options, including in vitro fertilization, and then egg freezing and surrogacy. And then we'll talk about genetic testing, starting from genetic testing you can do prior to conception, all the way through the pregnancy, and then we'll talk about postnatal testing as well. And then we'll bring up some cases and ethical issues and things like that in the end. So this is a normal fertility curve. So if you're looking at a population of, let's say, 100 couples who are trying to get pregnant, every month about 15% of the people are going to get pregnant. So actually the pregnancy rate per month is pretty low, 15%. These are people who are on no contraception wanting to get pregnant. By the time a year has gone by, it's a 12-month study here, about 85% of the people are going to be pregnant. And so at the end of a year, you're left with about 10 to 15% of people who are considered infertile or subfertile. And infertility is defined as 1 year of well-timed, unprotected intercourse without a pregnancy. Infertility is has different causes. And the big thing to look at here is that about half of infertility is from a female cause, about half is from a male cause when you're looking at the male-female, 40%, 40%. And then there's this 20% where it's unexplained. So you may have a couple that comes in, like Gloria and Mike, and you do the entire workup and all the tests, and everything comes back normal. And then they would fall into that group called unexplained infertility. And we can do things for people who have unexplained fertility as well. I'm going to go over some really basic things here about the female reproductive organs, so everyone knows how things work. Okay, so this is what happens. You probably know this, but this is just a brief review. Every month, a woman forms an egg, a follicle in her ovary. A follicle is a fluid collection that has an egg inside of it. When an egg gets to a place where it's mature, the follicle or the fluid collection ruptures and releases the egg. The egg is then picked up by the fallopian tube, and it goes into the fallopian tube, and it sits right around here. If she's going to get pregnant, right, sperm comes in the vagina, through the cervix, into the uterus, and it meets the egg up in the fallopian tube. So So fertilization actually takes place here in the fallopian tube. It takes about 2 or 3 days for that little fertilized embryo to move down into the uterus, and then 2 or 3 more days for it to find a place to implant in the uterus. So that's what typically happens. Ovulation itself is pretty complex, but I'm going to go over the most important thing that you need to know, and that is that every month after a woman has a period, her pituitary gland up in her brain releases FSH, follicle-stimulating hormone. Follicle-stimulating hormone gives a message to the ovary to allow an egg to mature. And as that egg matures, the fluid around it grows until, like I said, it gets to a point where this fluid collection or this follicle ruptures and releases an egg. As an egg grows, it releases a type of estrogen called estradiol, and the estradiol feeds back onto your brain, and it tells your brain to shut off the FSH. And this is what happens every month. And if you're not pregnant, the estradiol then drops down, and the FSH rises again, and the same thing happens. There are lots of causes of female infertility, and we'll go over some of these. The most important one is age. A woman is born with her lifetime egg supply. At least that's what we believe. Although there was a study done recently in mice that showed that they are actually making eggs throughout their lifetime. So that was, nobody could believe, you know, that was something that we didn't believe, and that's just been proven to be true. As far as we know, we're born with our lifetime egg supply. When we are inside of our moms, we're a 20-week fetus, we have the most eggs we'll ever have. We have 4 million. At birth, we have 400,000. By the time we go through puberty, we have 100,000. So you can see they're just sort of dropping off pretty quickly. And then our fertility initially declines when we're 27 years of age. And then it drops off significantly between the ages of 37 and 38. And then we see rare pregnancies after the age of 44, although you see them all the time in People magazine. Right? You know, she was 47 and she was 50 and had twins, and people come in and they say, you know, I'm 45 and I'm really ready to start my family, and they don't realize that they don't have any eggs left. So it's a really important thing to understand and to pass on to everybody that you know, is that if you want to have children, if you can, it's better to start younger when the eggs are healthier, because really you don't see many pregnancies into the 40s unless you use someone else's eggs. This is another thing emphasizing how important age is. These are married women, and you can see as the woman's age increases that the amount of the infertility increases. So in these women aged 40 to 44, 28.7% of them are infertile. And again, this shows what happens to eggs as the woman's age increases. There's a lot more genetic abnormalities in the eggs, and this can cause embryos not to form or embryos to be abnormal, not to implant, or implanted embryos to miscarry. And actually, when women are in their 40s, the miscarriage rate is 50% or more for each pregnancy. Another important thing when we're looking at infertility is the menstrual cycle and ovulation. It's important. You have to release an egg to be able to get pregnant. There are a lot of women who don't ovulate. That's called anovulation. Common causes for that are hormone imbalances, obesity, anorexia, significant stress. And a woman who's not ovulating will have irregular menstrual cycles, she'll skip cycles, and probably will have minimal or absent premenstrual symptoms like breast tenderness and bloating and the type of things that PMS symptoms that people have. Briefly, we talked about premature ovarian failure. That's what Gloria's aunt had. She was 30, she went through menopause. That can happen. People use up all their eggs at a very early age. And like I said, it can be genetic. And so if you have a relative who has that, it's important to see a physician and see if that's a possibility for you. Fallopian tubes need to be open for pregnancy to occur. At least one needs to be open. And one of the most common causes of blocked tubes is chlamydia. This is a picture of, this is the X-ray test that I do on everyone who comes through my office, and this is a uterus, a sort of upside-down triangle here is a uterus, and then this thing over here that kind of looks like a worm, there's one here and there's one here, those are fallopian tubes. They're very small, like as small as a little piece of spaghetti, and in this one, it's kind of hard to see, but these are open. They're thin and they're open, and this is dye that I'm pushing through here, it's coming all the way through. And these are blocked fallopian tubes. So again, this is the uterus. This is a very normal uterus. But these tubes, you can see, are really big. They kind of look like sausages. And they're blocked at the ends. Nothing can get through. The uterus can be a cause of infertility. There's something called fibroids, which you may have heard of. 25 to 30% of women have them. They're benign muscle tumors. And if you have a fibroid that comes into the uterine cavity, it can do one of two things. One thing is it can kind of act like an IUD, an intrauterine device, or like a foreign body that will cause an embryo to be expelled out of the uterus so a pregnancy won't occur. Or if a pregnancy tries to implant right here and tries to grow a blood supply, there really isn't a good blood supply in this fibroid, and so you might miscarry if you have a fibroid. So these are things that we try to take out if they're in the wrong place. Again, this is a normal-shaped uterus, triangle, and this is a uterus with fibroids. This is a fibroid right here, and there's actually a big fibroid right here, and this tube is going up around the fibroid. So she has two big fibroids in bad places that should be taken out. And then this is a really interesting category. It's Mullerian defects or congenital defects of the uterus. Some women are born without a uterus, and it's called the Rokitansky-Meyer-Kusterhauser syndrome. And I went to medical school just to learn that, actually. It took me 4 years. And that what happens is, so our uterus, fallopian tubes, and the upper two-thirds of the vagina all come from the same embryological source. So in some women, it just doesn't form. So they have ovaries. They develop like a normal woman does, but they don't have a uterus. Typically, the first time they come in to see a physician is when they're a late teen and they haven't had a period yet. All their friends have, they haven't. They come in to see you, they look totally normal, normal breast development, normal external genitalia. Then you do an exam and you find that they only have a lower third of their vagina, it's about an inch long, and they have no uterus. Yeah.
They would probably know that something's wrong, right, if they haven't ever had their menstrual cycle.
Right. That's typically when they come in. So they, you know, everything's normal. They develop completely like all their girlfriends have. Now, all of a sudden, all their friends have had their menstrual cycle, and they're, you know, 17, 18, and they come in. And that's the first time, a lot of times, where they're going to find out, because there's not going to be any other symptoms. So that's a very difficult conversation to have with somebody. The good thing about it is that they have ovaries. If they want children in the future, they can have children that are genetically their own children, but they're going to need someone else to carry the pregnancy. So they would need a surrogate, and we'll talk more about that. And then another thing that can happen is when we are inside of our moms, we actually form, our uterus is actually in two horns like this. And then what happens before we're born is that this top part goes away and we have this uterus. Remember, that looked like a triangle. Some people, they always stay and have two. It's called a bicornuate uterus. And a bicornuate uterus, you can get pregnant, but it's a small cavity. So people seem to have preterm labor and problems like that with their pregnancies. Some people, this part up here will never go away, and it's actually called a uterine septum. It's a fibrous band of tissue at the top of their uterus, and it's a very difficult place for an embryo to implant. So that's what this is a picture of. This is either, you don't know from this picture whether this is a bicornuate uterus with two horns here and here, or if this is a fibrous band in the center that you can actually remove. So you could actually go in here with a little camera and instruments and take this out, and then they would have a normal uterus. So you'd basically do another test after this, and if they did have a septum in their uterus, you could do a hysteroscopy, which is taking this camera, putting it in through the vagina, through the cervix, into the uterus, and you could take care of a septum or fibroids or polyps or anything that grows inside the uterus. You could take it out. Or you can do a laparoscopy where you take the same instruments, camera, you put it through the belly button, and you can take care of masses and fibroids and things that people have on the outside of their uterus. So that's sometimes, you know, what we have to do to get people ready to be able to have a baby. And like I said, surrogate mothers, surrogates are what people need who have either no uterus, a uterus with so many fibroids or, you know, masses inside that you can't take care of, or sometimes women who've gone through many IVF cycles, in vitro fertilization cycles that haven't worked sometimes, and they have really nice-looking embryos, and you can't figure out why they're not implanting. Sometimes they may choose to have a surrogate and have their embryos placed into somebody else. Surrogates typically If someone is a surrogate, they're typically paid about $25,000 to be a surrogate. And part of being a surrogate is giving up all legal rights to this child. So once you give birth to the child, you give it to the parents and you have no legal rights. There's very binding contracts for all of this stuff. And then cervix, I won't really go into that, but you can have problems with your cervix that cause infertility. There can be hormone problems, like your thyroid gland is out of whack, and that can cause problems with menstrual cycles. Or stress or exercise at the bottom here can cause people to have infertility, especially if you know about very thin ballet dancers, people who are long-distance runners, that type of thing. Their menstrual cycles can become very erratic or disappear. And then the final things for female infertility are chromosome abnormalities. Turner syndrome is the most common chromosome abnormality that there is. And what that is a woman who only has one X chromosome. So instead of having two X chromosomes, they just have one. People with Turner syndrome have usually a distinct phenotype. So they look a certain way. They're short. They're usually less than 5 feet tall. They have what's called a webbed neck. They have extra skin here. It goes like this. They have what's called a shield chest. Nipples are very far apart. They have heart defects sometimes. They have kidney defects sometimes. And they have very abnormal ovaries because they just have one X chromosome. So normal ovaries are about the size of a walnut. And their ovaries are just like a little piece of string, almost, just like a little white piece of string inside. And they have very few, if any, eggs in their ovaries. So person with Turner syndrome, there are rare pregnancies where someone does have a few eggs and one of those eggs gets fertilized and they have a pregnancy. But typically, if you want to have a pregnancy and you have Turner syndrome, you would use someone else's eggs and you would be able to carry the pregnancy because they have a normal uterus. Another thing is androgen insensitivity. It sounds like you talked about this already. This is the genotype is male, they're XY, but phenotypically they're female. It's also called a male pseudohermaphrodite. And what happens here is that when the baby's born, they look like a female. Androgens are things like testosterone, typical male hormones. They release these hormones, but their receptors, the androgen receptors, don't work properly. And so their body doesn't sense that they have the androgens, and so they don't form like a male. Instead, they look like a female. They have no uterus. They have no ovaries. They have that blind vaginal canal that's probably like an inch. And then about 50% of them will have an inguinal hernia, which means a hernia right here in the groin. And within that hernia will be testes, gonads in there. You want to remove those. And the most well-known case of this is Jamie Lee Curtis. She has androgen insensitivity. Okay, so male infertility. This is its sperm penetrating the surface of an egg. So male infertility is about 40% of infertility, and the causes are abnormalities in sperm production, so the count, abnormalities in sperm function, which would be the motility, how well they move, and how well they penetrate the egg, and then obstructions in the ductal system, in the male reproductive system. Okay, so a little review again. Testicle right here, that's where testosterone and sperm is produced. The sperm is stored in this structure that surrounds the testicle called the epididymis. And then when ejaculation occurs, the sperm goes along this vas deferens. This is what is tied off in a vasectomy, when someone has a vasectomy, and comes through here, and then the seminal vesicle gives it some mucus, and the prostate gland gives it some more stuff, and then it goes out through urethra and out of the body. Whenever a couple comes in, I always order a semen analysis. And the things that I want to see, look at, are the volume, which should be greater than 2 milliliters, the concentration, which should be greater than 20 million sperm per cc. There should be more than 50% of the sperm moving. And then the most important thing that's kind of newer is morphology. Morphology is the way that a sperm looks. And we use something in the 40% normal morphology is the World Health Organization criteria. We use something in my office and probably in most reproductive endocrine offices called the Kruger-Strict criteria, where normal is greater than or equal to 14%. So you can see most sperm are actually abnormal looking. You only need to have that 14% to be normal. And when we see less than 4% of sperm being normal looking, then you don't have a very good fertilization rate. So it's actually the best predictor of fertilizing ability. So here's some sperm. These are normal. Sperm have three parts to them. They have a head, they have a midpiece, which is this little thicker area here, and then they have a tail. And all of those sperm are normal. Here is a conehead sperm. It's like a tapered head. This one has two heads. These guys have little holes in their head, little vacuoles, here and here and here. Big mid pieces. This should be small. This have these big mid pieces. Another one, you know, tapered heads here, broken tails. So there's all of these different abnormalities that we see commonly. So how many sperm do you need for fertilization? So if you're just at home having sex, you need to have 20 million sperm, like I said in the semen analysis. If you're talking about doing intrauterine inseminations, which is something that we do in my office, you need about 1 million to 10 million sperm. Intrauterine inseminations are when you take, the man will give you semen sample, you process it, wash it, concentrate it down, get the best, most motile sperm, and you take them and you put them inside the woman's uterus so that the sperm are closer to the fallopian tubes, and you basically just try to get the best sperm closer to the eggs to increase chances of fertilization. So you need about 1 million. For in vitro fertilization, where you take eggs out of the woman's body and you take sperm from the man and you put them together in a petri dish, you need about 10,000 to 100,000 sperm. And then to do something called ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, you need one. And that is, we do that in, I'll go into it, but lots of different cases where we would use ICSI. Basically with that, you just look under a microscope and you pick out a really good looking sperm and you inject a single sperm into an egg. Okay, so a little bit more on this. Abnormalities in sperm productions, that would be sperm count, can be caused by from genetic causes. Typically, that would be like a Y chromosome microdeletion where part of the Y chromosome is missing. Problems with the testes. Cryptorchidism is when the testicles actually are inside the body and they've never descended. Varicocele is when the veins around the testicles are swollen. And both of those things, having testes in your body or having lots of swollen blood vessels around the testicle, causes heat. And it causes sperm count to decrease. And then infections like mumps can cause long-term problems with sperm production. And then things that are toxic to sperm, like we talked about. But most of those things are temporary, unless you're talking about steroids or some chemotherapy and radiation as well. And then sperm function, or the way that the sperm move, can be affected by antibodies that are directed against the sperm, by infections, or like from these veins that are swollen around the testicles. And then you can have obstructions in the system that goes from the testicle and all the way to the outside of the body. One is you could have had a vasectomy. I have a lot of patients who come in. They had their children, had a vasectomy. Now they're in a new relationship. Maybe they're in the same relationship, but they decide they want another child, and they have this obstructed tube. You can do two things with that. You can go in, and you can put the tube back together. So you can do microsurgery. Cut ends, make them fresh, put them back together, sew them back up. The other thing you can do if someone has a vasectomy is just bypass it and go straight to the testicle, put a needle in there, take sperm out, and then use it, probably ICSI, like I talked about, where you take single sperm and you stick them into an egg. And then there are people that are born without their vas deferens. So congenitally, both sides are absent, but they have everything else. So the sperm just can't get where it needs to go. Or they can have congenital problems with the other structures along the way, the epididymis, the ejaculatory ducts. And in that case, what you typically have to do is you need to just go straight to the source, and you need to go to the testicle and do biopsy. And then lifestyle for the man. We talked about most of these already. But all of these things here can affect sperm production, motility, and morphology.
I've heard that there's been an overall drop in sperm count. I don't know if it's worldwide or just in the United States over the past, 50, 60 years. Have you heard about that?
I actually don't know about that. Okay, so now we've talked about causes of infertility. Like Gloria and Mike, when they came in, I would see them. I said I would do blood work on them, do a semen analysis. Yeah.
I just have a I just had a quick question. When I was little, people used to say that Mountain Dew would decrease sperm count. Is that just because of the caffeine?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just wondering. So then all soda in general?
If you drink enough of it.
Not just Mountain Dew.
No, caffeinated.
Okay.
Caffeinated soda, yeah.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Does that include coffee?
Yes. Just
any type of caffeine?
Yes. So, like I said, we do this workup. You're still going to have about 15 to 20% of people that come in to see you have nothing wrong. Everything just looks perfect, but they're not being able to get pregnant. So you have to start looking at treatments. If there's something, someone has big fibroids, someone has blocked tubes, someone has an abnormal sperm count, you can start working those things up, trying to take care of them, see what you can do, and to treat those things. And then hopefully maybe people can go home once things are fixed and just try to get pregnant on their own. But for some people, like I said, we're not going to find anything. So let's talk about treatments. What do we do? One thing is to talk to people about timing intercourse, because many people don't do it right. And a lot of people time intercourse after ovulation occurs. They use these kits at home that show ovulations happening, and they wait until the peak. And basically, they've already ovulated. And then they say, okay, it's time, come home or whatever, and it's too late. And so we talk about that you need to have sperm there waiting in the fallopian tubes for the eggs to come down. That's really important that the sperm is waiting there. Talk about that. And then sometimes people come in and they're just not having sex. So that happens. We don't do that or whatever. And other times they're not having it in the right place. So you just have to talk about how things work and how things are supposed to happen normally, and sometimes that's all they need. True. That's true. So...
Go ahead, Daisy.
Yeah?
Mike, ask back, please. Thank you.
I have two questions.
Yeah.
The first is, what do you mean by not in the right place?
Well...
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, not the location in the house.
Yeah.
Everywhere, yeah.
And the second question...
Forgot. Okay.
Why does he shoot?
Is there a problem if a couple's trying to have a baby and they like have sex like 3 times a day for a month?
Yeah, it's actually better if you want to have the best success at having a pregnancy. You want to have sex every other day. The reason is because sperm typically lasts about 48 hours, and you have time in that 48 hours to let it build up again. When I do inseminations in the office, for example, a man will give it, we do it 2 days in a row. He'll give his sample, and then he'll give it the next day. I'm always looking at these numbers, and they almost always go down. If you're going every other day, then it goes down. So if you give it another day, it builds up again. And basically, by doing it every other day, there's just sperm there all the time. And I mean, I don't mean every other day for the every day, you know, of the month, but around the time of ovulation. Yeah.
Are those women who only, you were talking about women who only have like the lower third of their
yes.
vagina, are those women not trying to conceive? Are they able to have sex normally, or is that not
yeah.
possible?
Yeah, they actually, so what used to be done for these women in the past is they would do this procedure called a Macindoe procedure, where they would take skin like from the outer thigh and inner thigh, and they would build a vagina, and then they'd put this thing inside of it to keep it open, and pretty awful actually what they had to do, and a lot of them would close back down. What they do now is they use something called Frank dilators, that's named after Dr. Frank, but they're just progressive dilators basically that are kind of like little things that get bigger and bigger and bigger. And women are asked to start using them around the time when they think they're going to start having sex. And they kind of are on top of like a little seat, like a basketball seat. And they basically just sit on them. And they sit on them for like a half an hour a day, read or whatever. And then they just get you know, slowly bigger and bigger. And they work really, really well. And they can have a very functional, normal vagina, although not attached to any cervix or uterus or anything.
Nico.
Are they able to physically like enjoy sex at all? Or
yes.
Really? Even
yes.
If they had to build it or expand it by using the seat things? Yes. Have the right nerve endings?
Yeah, because typically what they say is that, you know, it depends. But a lot of people think and believe, and from studies that have been done, that you don't need a cervix or a uterus or anything to have pleasure from sex, and that women who've had hysterectomies and had all that removed don't have any difference, and that these women still have a clitoris, and they still have mucous membranes and everything and nerves, and that they can have good sex. Yeah.
Look, of all the reasons for infertility, like, there wasn't, like, taking birth control pill for, like, extended amount of time.
No, and that's a myth.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter.
No, it does not matter. You don't need to take a break from a birth control pill. Mm-mm. And birth control pills have lots of benefits, actually, too. Like, decreases ovarian cancer and things like that.
Even if you take it for, like, 7 years?
Even if you take it for 15, 20. Don't worry.
What about other forms of birth control?
How they affect fertility?
Like Depo or
yeah.
The ring.
I mean, Depo, you know, the ring shouldn't do anything. The Depo can hold off periods. So once you stop, the Depo Provera is a shot that you get, kind of like a birth control pill, but it's in a shot that lasts for 3 months. What can happen is when you take your last Depo shot, people can go up to a year without having a period. So yes, it can affect it in that way, in that you might have to wait a while before you can start getting pregnant if you use Depo Provera. But it's not going to hold it off indefinitely, maybe up to a year at the most.
So there's none of the different types of birth control have a risk of it? No. Like, I've heard, like the morning after, like, that still that's just all.
No, not unless you had a problem with that. Let's say someone takes a morning after, you may take it so early you don't really have any, you know. If you do things, you can take some of those pills to terminate a pregnancy later. That could be a problem if you end up not releasing all the tissue and you have an infection, and like we talked about in that case history. But otherwise, no. Mm-mm. Anything else? Okay. So once you find out if they're having sex the right way and the right time and all that, and things still aren't happening, then what we typically move on to initially is something called an intrauterine insemination, which I talked about before, where we take sperm and we place it inside the uterine cavity so it's closer to the eggs. And this is a picture of how that works, where you take a little catheter that has the sperm in it, put it up inside the uterus. You can see the fallopian tubes. They come off right there by where you're going to put this in. And this is just the tip of the catheter and the fluid, and there's millions of sperm in there. And what we try to do initially is we try to increase the number of eggs that the woman makes so that hopefully one of those eggs will fertilize. And then we try to put the best sperm closer to the eggs. That's just very simple, and that's called medication plus insemination, or IUI. So we try to base our treatments on experiments, like you talk about in this class, you know, design an experiment. So this was an experiment that was designed to look at how should you treat people who have unexplained infertility. People who have been coming in, trying for a year, you don't find anything wrong with them. How do we treat them? So they looked at these three groups. They looked at one group where the woman just had her normal menstrual cycle on her own, and around the time of ovulation, they did an insemination. That's the first group. And they had a 2.7% pregnancy rate per cycle. In the next group, what they did was they gave the woman medicine, FSH medicine, like your own pituitary makes. They gave her injections of FSH to try to make more than one egg every month, and then they had sex. And that group had 6.1% pregnancy rate per cycle. And then they put the two together. Gave the woman medicine so she made more eggs, put the sperm closer to the eggs, and that group had a 26.4% pregnancy rate per cycle. That's why we do this. For unexplained fertility, this is the first thing that we go into, is this insemination with medication. Two medications are used. The first one's called Clomid. It's been around forever. And Clomid is actually an anti-estrogen. It's a pill that a woman takes 5 days out of the month, and it makes your body believe that it's low in estrogen, even though it's not. And because it believes it's low in estrogen, it puts out more FSH. It says, oh, you know, it's the feedback loop here. That's not working, so we need more FSH. So your own body kind of does its own thing, giving its body its own drug, FSH. And then hopefully, maybe two or three eggs will form instead of one that month. We can be more aggressive than that, and we can give FSH right to her through an injection, so that's at an even higher level. And typically using FSH like that, you're going to make three or more eggs every month. you can get in trouble with this. This is how very big multiple births happen, like the ones on the cover of Good Housekeeping or whatever every Christmas that you see, the seven. Those were FSH IUI babies. So the woman was given this medicine. She had lots of eggs grow. She was advised not to have an insemination done, not to have sex because it was too dangerous. And they did. They went home. They've been wanting a baby, I mean, forever. Went home and had sex and had seven. So that's how that happens. It doesn't usually happen with in vitro fertilization. It happens with this type of thing. Okay, so then we'll talk about in vitro fertilization. So this would be the next step. You've tried timing, you've tried the inseminations, and then you need to move on to something more aggressive. So why would you do in vitro fertilization? So simply for infertility. Other treatments haven't worked. The tubes are blocked and you just need to bypass the tubes. There's very significant sperm abnormalities. Those are reasons why you might do in vitro fertilization. Or that you want to do DNA testing and you want to test embryos before they're implanted back into the uterus for genetic disorders, maybe for gender selection. For example, if a family has a sex-linked disease that runs in their family, like hemophilia, they might only want to have girls. Or they can do gender selection for family balancing. They have three girls, they want a boy. Or non-traditional lifestyles. I mean, typically same-sex couples. They want to come in and have a baby, and sometimes the best way to do that is through in vitro fertilization. Or maybe a single woman who comes in, late 30s, hasn't found the right guy kind of thing, wants to have a baby, maybe freeze her eggs to use them for later. So those would be examples. In vitro fertilization has been around for about 30 years. The first test tube baby was born in 1978. She was born in England. And then the first baby in the U.S. born in 1981. We started IVF with procedures that are called GIFT and ZIFT. GIFT means gamete intrafallopian transfer. ZIFT is zygote intrafallopian transfer. So the thought was, when in vitro fertilization first came about, listen, let's take eggs and sperm, or let's take zygotes, fertilized eggs and sperm, and put them back where they belong, in the tube. And then maybe that will work. So the woman would have eggs taken out of her body, they'd be put together in the petri dish with the sperm, and a zygote would be made, and then she would have an operation, and we put them back in her tube. Or we just take the eggs and sperm by themselves, give her this operation, put them in her tube. That's how things started. And people were having successful pregnancies like that. We still do it occasionally, maybe 1 or 2% of the time that we'll do that. But now we don't do that anymore. Now we take them, make them in the petri dish, and then we put them right back in the uterus. So the woman doesn't have to undergo this surgical procedure. And the success rates are just as good or better, putting it straight into the uterus. So I've already alluded to how this works, but in IVF, what we do is we give the woman FSH medication. They're injections that she gets daily, causing eggs to grow on her ovaries. Now, one important thing to note about this is that you don't use up eggs by doing any of these procedures. You're not using eggs that wouldn't have been lost anyway. Typically, every month, you have a supply of eggs that are there. Only one will grow to maturity, and the rest will die away. What we're doing is we're recruiting the rest of those eggs to grow along with that other one. And by giving more FSH, you can do that because the receptors, they all have receptors, but typically only one has enough receptors to grow. Now many of them will have enough receptors to grow. So we have a lot of eggs growing on here. Take the eggs out of the woman's body, and we'll go into that a little bit more. Put them in the dish, put the sperm in, let them incubate. By the next morning, you know how many fertilized. And then when you have fertilized eggs, usually 3 days after the eggs have and the sperm have fertilized, put them back inside the uterus. In 2000, there were 383 U.S. programs that offered IVF. About 100,000 cycles of IVF were done. 7,581 of those were donor egg cycles, where you would use eggs from another person. She would donate them to you. And there were over 25,000 deliveries. And you can see that the amount of babies that were born was more than that, and that's because of multiple births, twins, triplets. We'll go into that some more, too. So who needs IVF? People who failed other treatments, people whose tubes are blocked, someone with a significant male factor, like a very low count, very abnormal morphology, like we talked about, someone who doesn't have a uterus, someone who carries a genetic disease, someone who wants gender selection for one reason or the other, And then cancer patients, that can be in a man or a woman. Maybe a woman, a young woman who finds out she has lymphoma or something like that. She decides before she's going to have her chemotherapy, before she's going to have her radiation, that we're going to take eggs out and we're going to freeze them so she can use them later. Because oftentimes chemotherapy or radiation will kill all the eggs that are there. Another example would be a man, for example, Lance Armstrong, testicular cancer. Let's take sperm and keep, you know, put it aside and then have all the treatment done. And so they had their babies with in vitro fertilization. Yeah.
Is there a limitation on genetic diseases that can be tested for, or theoretically, could any genetic disease be detected?
Theoretically, anyone could, yes. Okay. That you could form a probe to look for that disease. Yeah.
We might be going into this in a little bit with ethical stuff, but yeah. I was just wondering if there's a law regarding gender selection.
No, there's not a law, and we will go into it a little bit more. There are there's different ways to select for gender. One is something called which I wasn't going to talk about. One is called microsort. It is a research. It's all done by research protocol right now, but it's basically a way to spin sperm down and then use it to inseminate. Where you can get about 90% chance of having a girl, about a 70% chance of having a boy. So that's one thing that you can do. Another thing you can do is actually make embryos, like I'm talking about here, take a single cell off of the embryo and check to see if it's a boy or a girl and only put back the desired sex. And no, there aren't any laws. Most places that do it typically, let's say they're just doing it because they for this family balancing, will typically only do it for the underrepresented sex in the family. Like someone can't just come in and say, we want a boy, we don't have any kids and we want a boy, or we want more boys and we have two. It has to be, we have two girls, we want a boy. That's typically how it is, but there are no guidelines on that. Anything?
Betty, you have a question?
Like, when you freeze the sperm, do you just stop all, like, cell activity so the DNA is still as fresh as it, still, like, not degraded, even though you freeze it for a long time, it's still as good as,
well, like, you know, yes, let's say the sperm that survive are just as good. Typically what you have when you freeze and thaw anything is you have a loss. I mean, there's a rate of loss with anything, whether you're freezing sperm or eggs or embryos. But the ones that thaw and survive are normal. Yeah. Okay, so a little more detail with IVF. What we do is we give, like I said, we give the woman an FSH medication in the form of an injection. And then this is her ovary. And all of these little circles are these follicles that are growing. So instead of just one growing, she's got a lot. And this is just looking through one plane in her ovary. So she's got a lot more than that in there. And then what happens is they get bigger as the eggs mature, and then we go and retrieve them. And this is actually a needle going into her ovary right here. The way that this is done, it's done vaginally with ultrasound guidance, where we take a needle, place it through the vaginal wall into the ovary, and then with suction, we basically just suck this fluid out of there. And when you suck the fluid out of there, you hope that the egg comes with it. And you do it for this one will collapse, and this one, and this one, and this one. And that's how you do it and get the eggs out. Then we can look at the eggs under the microscope. This is a really nice egg. It's symmetrical. Cytoplasm is very light. This is a bad-looking egg. It's dark. It's sort of irregular around the borders. What happens the day that the eggs are retrieved, they're put together with sperm, and then about 24 hours later, we look and we see how many of those fertilized. This is a fertilized, so this is a little embryo that's just starting, two pronuclei, one from the woman, one from the man, right here. So this is one day after egg retrieval. And then we grow them out to day 3. And at day 3, you should have a 6 to 8 cell embryo, so they're dividing daily. And we grade the embryos based on the symmetry of the cells, which are called blastomeres, and also by how clear and clean it is inside the embryo, because some embryos have a lot of debris inside. We grade them from 1 to 4, and 4 is the best. This is an 8-cell, there are 8, you can't see the other ones. This is an 8-cell grade 4 embryo, so this is basically a perfect embryo on day 3. That's a grade 1. This one on day three has not even gotten to 6 to 8 cells. It only has 3 cells in it, and it's got all of this debris inside of it. And it's kind of a beauty contest a little bit, because the prettier embryos implant better. If this embryo implants, though, it's not going to make an abnormal baby. It's just going to have a less likely, you know, there's less likelihood that it is going to implant, but if it implants, it should be genetically normal. If we let them grow for 2 more days, then they become a blastocyst. Just they keep dividing, they get an inner cell mass, and this is the source of stem cells. And then what typically happens is the blastocyst hatches out of its shell and then attaches to the wall of the uterus. Once we have those day 3 embryos, we transfer them back in the uterus. So this is a uterus right here. Cervix is up here. The top of the uterus is here. And we put the little embryos in the catheter. This is actually a catheter in between these 2 lines. Put it in through the woman's cervix, up into the top of the uterus. This is called the endometrium. And we deposit it right here. That's where the L is. These are little embryos that are deposited at the top of the uterus. So we can do special IVF procedures. You can just sort of do this typical IVF where we did what I described, and then you put the embryos back. Some people need more than that. Some people need assistance in the hatching of the embryo. This is usually women that are older, reproductive age, which is 38 or older, where the shell around the embryo gets hard and the embryo has a hard time hatching out. So we'll take acid and make a little hole right there, and then this is empty. So this is an empty shell, and it's hatched out. Or we can do ICSI, that intracytoplasmic sperm injection, where you take one nice-looking sperm and you put it into an egg. This is an egg, this is a needle, and this is the sperm head right here. And you put the needle through the wall of the egg and into the egg, and then the sperm is deposited inside of here. And you have about an 80% fertilization rate or higher using ICSI. And this was actually discovered by mistake. It was just someone working, you know, with eggs and sperm, and the needle slipped and went in and had a sperm in it, and the next day there was a fertilized egg. That's how that was discovered, like lots of great inventions. So, okay, so then this is a big ethical issue. How many embryos should you put back inside? So let's say that a woman makes, I get 20 eggs, and she has 14 embryos, and she's 30 years old. I'm not going to put back 14 embryos. But you do need to decide how many embryos to put back. And there are national guidelines in the United States, and these are the guidelines that are up here. And they're age-related. And what these guidelines try to achieve is a good pregnancy rate, but not with the lowest multiple rate possible. So there's a balance there. And even so, though, we have about a 30 to 35% twin rate using this. And in the general, you know, population, twinning naturally is at 1 in 80 pregnancies. So it's really significantly increased. And there was a big article in the New York Times in the last year that discussed doctors putting in too many embryos and the results and what happens there, and the pressure that physicians are feeling from their patients saying, you need to put in more. You know, we're paying for this. We want more. We want a higher chance of pregnancy occurring. And so there's a lot of, you know, issues about how many should you put in and what's safe, what's not safe. And there are certain countries where they will put back only one embryo, and that's the law, and that's the way it is, like Italy, for example. They put a single embryo in, which was originally came about for religious reasons in Italy, and that's so become a standard in many European countries, actually. We don't do that here. Yeah.
Some people, I think, have a higher chance of having twins naturally. So does that affect if you put 2, that they'll have a higher chance?
It actually doesn't. No. Yeah.
You were talking about Italy, and they only put 1 embryo in. Does that still mean, though, that they take, that they still make the same number of potential embryos and only put 1 back in the uterus, or is it that they work with less to begin with?
That's a good question, because that's another issue for certain people and countries and different things is, what do you do with those embryos that are left over? And we'll talk about that right here. But they, yes, they probably would not stimulate them as aggressively as we would. Yeah. So in this case, do you have a question?
Yeah, I'm just curious. When you have a lot of kids, for example, people that had 7, is that generally dangerous?
Yes.
To have that many?
Yes. And I will go into that. That is dangerous. Yep. Yeah.
With ICSI, what happened with the normal physiological responses like acrosomal reaction or nucleus?
Yeah, it's interesting. So you're bypassing all that, but you're still getting fertilization, which is really interesting.
How does it...
But the reason why is that's not true. To do ICSI, you make the acrosome reaction happen. You have to break the tail. Okay, you slap those like this, break the tail, and that actually lets those enzymes release. You need enzymes to release from the sperm head to make all of this happen. And if you just inject it in with a nice sperm and you don't do anything to it, it doesn't work. So these were sort of more accidental, you know, things that were done. But you actually have to kink the tail and break it.
And that will release the nucleus?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay, so like this example, we got 20 eggs, 14 embryos, we put 2 back. So then what do you do with the remaining 12 embryos that you have? Typically what people decide to do is to freeze their embryos. And embryos have been frozen as many as 20 years and been thawed out and caused normal pregnancies. So typically people will freeze them. Why will they freeze them? 2 reasons. One is, let's say that we do this IVF cycle, put the 2 embryos in, and they don't get pregnant, right? So 2 weeks later we do a pregnancy test, they're not pregnant. Well, instead of going through the entire process again, now we can thaw out some embryos. Maybe we'll thaw out 2 or 3 embryos, and we'll have another chance at doing it. And I have to go through everything and the egg retrieval and stimulation and all this. Or let's say that they get pregnant right away. That's great. And then in a couple of years, they want another baby. So let's thaw some more out in a couple of years and have another baby. Then people get to the point where they're done. Okay, so they're done having their kids, but they still have embryos. Let's say these people already had their 2 kids. Now they have 6 embryos left. You can store them indefinitely if you want. You have to pay to do that, but you could do that. Or you can decide what you're going to do with them. So one thing you can do is you can donate your embryos to research, for example, like stem cell research. You can do embryo adoption, where you give your embryos to another couple, or another woman or whatever who's wanting to have a pregnancy. Or you can discard the embryos, which would basically mean thawing the embryos and throwing them away. And there are a lot of interesting things come up with this. When people initially sign up for IVF, we need to think about long-term things, and they have to sign these contracts and discuss what they're going to do with their embryos. And they also have to think about what they're going to do with their embryos if they get divorced. Okay? Who gets them? Whose are they? What are you going to do? A lot of people will decide, well, if we get divorced, we're going to give them to research or something like that. What happens if one person in the couple dies? Where do they go? Because some people might choose that they're going to have a pregnancy after the other person's gone. You know, you hear about that kind of stuff happening. And what happens if both of the people die? You know, where are they going to go? So people have to sign all of this before doing IVF and make these decisions. The IVF success rates in 2000 are shown right here. And you can see, again, age is very important. And that our highest success rates are seen in the younger group, and this was these were the U.S. averages in 2000. And in parentheses are the averages for the center where I work, and you can see. I mean, people come in thinking, "Oh, if I do IVF, I'm going home with a baby for sure." But even our best success rates are 50% for one IVF cycle. Yeah.
Is that per cycle or is
per
cycle? Couple.
Per cycle. So if you go through one of these cycles that I've discussed, stimulating the ovaries, taking the eggs out, making embryos, putting them back, not talking about frozen cycles or anything, putting them back initially, that's what it's for. So you can see if you have more embryos, then you have it's going to increase your chances.
Is there a difference between the chances, or is there a difference after thawed versus before?
Yes. So in this group, so in this group where we're getting a 50% pregnancy rate on a fresh cycle, we're getting a 35% pregnancy rate on a frozen cycle. Mm-hmm.
Is that what the number next to it is?
These are national averages in 2000. These are the averages from where I work. See how good we are? No. But actually all these averages I'm sure have gone up. I just didn't have the data. And then this multiple pregnancy issue. 65% of the pregnancies resulting from IVF in 2000, and very similar now, 65% are singleton pregnancies, 30% twins, and right now in 2005 it was 30 to 35%, depending on what center You looked at 4% triplets, 0.2% higher order, meaning four or more. And here's a picture of a single pregnancy. So this is 4 weeks after the embryo transfer was done. We do an ultrasound 2 weeks after their positive pregnancy test. And this, so this is a six-week fetus. This is the black is the amniotic sac. That's the baby's head, the baby's body. Its little limbs are forming, limb buds. And this little Cheerio thing here is the yolk sac, and that's what nourishes the early pregnancy. Yeah.
I just had a question about the twins.
Yeah.
Is the rate of identical twins the same as?
The rate of identical twins is, that's a good question. I don't know if I know the answer to that question. I don't know. These are twins. So these are identical twins. These are in the same sac, these two little ones. This is one head, another head, right next to each other. It's a dangerous kind of twin to have this type of an identical twin because they can wrap around each other as they grow in the cords and everything. It's pretty dangerous. And conjoined twins look like this as well, twins that are stuck together, some part of their body. These are twins in two sacs. There's one here and there's one here. And these are triplets. So there's one sac, two sacs, three sacs. And the more of those you see, you know, it just makes you, you don't want to see that. So multiple pregnancy is a really, really big deal. And this is something, I mean, I stress to my patients who are saying, oh, please just put in one more embryo, you know. There are just so many reasons not to go beyond what these standards discuss. Maternal complications can occur, especially when you're talking about three or more. And those include preterm labor, being at bed rest through your entire pregnancy, increases in something called preeclampsia, which is a very severe disorder only seen in pregnancy that requires immediate delivery, can result in seizures and strokes, gestational diabetes. These are just a few of the things that the women can go through. Fetal complications. The biggest thing is preterm birth. And what goes along with that is a long time in the neonatal intensive care unit, long-time disabilities, including problems breathing, problems with your vision, mental retardation, problems feeding, growing. Cost, financial costs, yes, to the hospital, to the public in general for having babies in the neonatal intensive care unit for weeks, months, years. Cost to the family, financial costs of bringing home three or more babies is quite big, but emotional costs to the family are huge, and the divorce rate for triplets or more is 85% or higher. People can choose to do, if they have triplets or more, they can choose to do a selective reduction, euphemism. Selective reduction is when you get rid of one or more of the babies and you reduce the pregnancy down to a twin pregnancy, which is much safer. The way that it's done at the end of the first trimester, done by specialists who do this all the time. And we wait till the end of the first trimester because multiple pregnancies, including twins, 25% of them will reduce on their own, naturally. So we wait to see if that will happen. If that doesn't happen and the couple wants to do a selective reduction, then what happens is that we take a needle that's placed either through the cervix or through the abdomen, and the needle is put into one of the sacs or two or however many you're reducing, and potassium chloride is injected into the sac and that baby's heart stops. That's what happens. You have a 5% chance of losing the entire pregnancy if you do this. So you can imagine people who are coming to you, you know, wanting more than anything to have a baby, and you know, you don't want to put them in a situation like this where they're trying to make a decision about if they're, you know, they've wanted this baby so badly and now are they going to reduce and do something to basically abort one of the babies. So you try not to get into a situation like that. So then, you know, it gets back to, should we be putting back single embryos? Success rates aren't going to be as high, and people want success. But so that's the big dilemma. And then IVF is very expensive. IVF cycle with medications is a minimum of $10,000 to $15,000. If you need some of these other procedures done, you can see that the costs rise. If you need to use someone else's eggs, you would pay that donor a minimum of $5,000. If you need someone else's uterus to carry the baby for you, minimum of $10,000 to $15,000, typically more like $25,000 on top of all the other costs that I'm talking about. And not most of this is not covered by insurance. Yeah.
For the freezing, is that a one-time fee or like a monthly fee?
No, it's a yearly fee, and it actually goes up year by year. And the reason it goes up year by year is to encourage people to do something with their embryos, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
After you already had the IVF cycle and medications once and you freeze the eggs, when you unfreeze them, and do you have to pay $10,000 again?
To unfreeze them? No. Yeah, so if you go through, no, if you go through this cycle and you have frozen embryos, and then we're going to do a frozen embryo transfer, we need to do things to get you ready for that. The woman does need medication to get her uterus ready, which is estrogen shots every 3 days, and ultrasounds and this type of thing. And then they need the thawing of the embryos and the transfer, and it costs about $2,500 to do that. Yeah.
Have there been cases where the surrogate, even though she signed a piece of paper, won't give over the baby, and what happens
yeah.
to her?
Yeah. I mean, there was one very famous case, which I was going to talk about, but then took it out, that occurred, I think, in the maybe late, I want to say in the early 80s, and it's called Baby M. I don't know if anyone's heard of it, but it was this woman, Mary Whitehead, and she was a surrogate for this family, and basically, like, ran away with the baby once she delivered by... She handed the baby out a window to her husband, who then took off with the baby to another state, and it was a real fiasco, and it was really publicized, and the baby went back to the birth parents, ultimately, but it was after months in a courtroom and all of, doing all of this stuff, so it was a disaster, and it just doesn't happen. It really doesn't happen. It's so rare, but when it does, it's you hear about it.
This might sound dumb because I'm a guy, but if you freeze it, can you just like, is there a special freezing technique, or can you put it like, in a freezer?
Oh no, they're special. They're special. You have to dehydrate it. Yeah.
Told you.
Yes, we do special things to dehydrate it, to take the fluid out of the cells, and then you can do quick freezing and slow freezing, and now we're starting to do egg freezing. Embryos freeze and thaw really well. Eggs don't. You know, typically they haven't. And that's because they're big cell and lots of fluid, and so they're doing special kind of freezing called vitrification. It's just a different type of freezing method that seems to work pretty well. Yeah, but it's special stuff. And should we take a break?
Let's take a break for about 5 minutes, and then we'll come back.
phrasing, it's a lot more difficult. But it is, it can be done. I have a couple questions about that. One, how much does it cost? Two, how, what do you do since it's not a fertilized egg? How do you get it back into the woman, and how does the pregnancy happen? Do you have to have IVF at that point? And then do you think that'll become more and more common as women are increasingly putting off pregnancy for career and... Oh, I have to turn it on. So those are good questions. So egg freezing is becoming sort of the new thing that's happening, the new wave, and a lot of research is being done. And where I work, we actually are just starting an egg freezing study. It's a national study, and we're one of the centers that are involved. So I have three of my patients just signed up to do this study. And what we're doing is taking eggs. People have to be 35 or younger to be in the study, just because you'll probably have more eggs to work with. We're going to take the do the IVF, you know, cycle, take the eggs out of their body, and then we're going to freeze them. So if you're, let's say, just a woman who wants to freeze her eggs, you could just freeze them and just leave it there until later. That would be, in this study, what we're going to do is we're going to freeze them, and a month later, we're going to thaw them and put them together with sperm and make embryos and put them back and see what the thaw rate is, see how many survive, what the survival rate is, what the fertilization rate is, and what the pregnancy rate is. So that's what this study is going to do. But if you're not in the study, you want to freeze your eggs, we would just, it would be very similar. We would freeze them, and then maybe you'd say in 5 years, you'd say, okay, I'm ready to use them, maybe like found the right sperm donor or something. And so you could thaw them at that point in time, put them together with sperm, make embryos, and then implant them.
Lisa, you had a question.
You said that women that smoke have 50% less chance of getting pregnant.
Yes.
Like, how long before a woman decides to have a child should she, like, quit in order to get that percentage up to 100%?
I don't know. I don't know that. I mean, this study is just a recent study that came out. We really didn't even know this about smoking and female fertility until recently. But I would probably, you know, say as soon as possible. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
Becca.
Samuel.
Sorry.
Sam.
So say a woman who was perfectly healthy, perfectly capable of carrying a baby, wanted to use a surrogate mother anyway for whatever reason, like for her career, for just wanting to avoid the health. Is that something that has been done?
Yes.
Kind of along the same lines, who would typically serve as a surrogate mother? Like a friend of the family, or do they pick a random person?
So it could be somebody known to them, like a sister, really good friend. Typically, it's somebody that they pick from a surrogacy agency. A lot of times when we talk about egg donation or surrogacy, people seem to tend to choose these more anonymous people just because of psychological implications that can occur, even if you think they're not going to, with carrying someone else's baby or giving your eggs to somebody, because then maybe the baby's born, you say, oh, you know, and I don't like the way they're raising my baby or whatever it is. People don't really sometimes realize the impact that has. So most of the time people will choose somebody from an agency. Why? I mean, I ask people typically if they're surrogate, why are you doing this? And the most frequent answers are, they almost always have children of their own. That's sort of a requirement for a surrogate because we want to know they can carry a pregnancy. We also want them to have a baby of their own in case something happens. I mean, pregnancy is not a benign thing. It's the most dangerous part of your young life as a woman. And so if something happened and she had a major complication and lost her uterus, I mean, what would she do? So we want people to have had a pregnancy, have had a nice pregnancy that was, you know, not hard on them. And so people will say, you know, I have a baby of my own and I want to give this gift to somebody else. And if my pregnancy was easy and I want to do this. Or I know somebody who wasn't able to have a baby and I want to be able to do this. Or I need some money to feed my kids. It's a big one. I need this money. And this is really going to help. And my pregnancy was so easy. And this is just going to be a great source of income for me. So those are the main.
Daisy.
If you get a surrogate from an agency, how do they control the lifestyle choices of the surrogate? I mean, as far as, like, how would you know and be able to trust that this surrogate person who you don't have any like emotional ties to or trust or anything like that would,
right,
you know, have...
I mean, it's true. You mainly have to trust that person, but that's something that is, whether you're an egg donor or surrogate or whatever, we really go into their background, their lifestyle, you know, social history, and you just have to trust what the person says, basically. And if there are inconsistencies, because they're, surrogates and egg donors are screened by the agencies, and then they're screened by the physician, and if you start to see a lot of inconsistencies and just things that don't go together, sometimes you'll say, I don't think this is the best person for you to use if you have concerns. Or if you see something that you think isn't going to be optimal, like recently I saw a very young donor who had just little ovaries with not a lot of eggs, and I said, I just don't think you should use her. So, you know, they are screened more than once, and then they do undergo, you know, psychological testing and that type of thing, but it's true.
And do they have, like, periodic checkups or anything to see just... that they're taking care of their body, like not even just like having to do with the pregnancy, but just to make sure that they're, you know, getting enough sleep or eating right and that kind of stuff.
I mean, they basically, the surrogates have the general prenatal testing, which includes monthly visits for the first two trimesters, and then moves into twice a month, and then weekly as the pregnancy goes on. But they don't have anything special or different than anybody else does that's pregnant. So.
Lola.
You had listed one of the causes of female infertility in the fallopian tubes is endometriosis.
Right.
What is that exactly?
Endometriosis is a condition where, remember I talked about the endometrium, that's the lining of the uterus. That's where the lining of the uterus gets outside of the uterus. That probably happens with everybody. So probably when women have a period, they probably have blood that comes out through the vagina, and they probably have blood that's retrograde that goes through the tubes and into their abdomen and stuff. But for most people, it's not a big deal. Your body takes care of it, your immune system. For some women, they can have endometrial cells, which should be inside their uterus, that implant other places in their body. And they can cause scarring, because when they have a period, those are going to bleed. They're going to bleed inside of you. And so it can cause significant pain. Sometimes people have very, very painful periods. They're missing school and missing work every month. Those are people who oftentimes have endometriosis. There have even been cases of endometriosis where that endometrium gets into people's lungs. And when they have their period, they cough up blood. So that's what it is. And it can cause scarring of your fallopian tubes and close them.
And how frequently does it cause infertility?
It really is related to infertility and miscarriages. So it's very prevalent, though. I mean, a lot of people have endometriosis, and it can affect fertility in very sort of subtle ways or in big ways if it closes the tubes. But it can also affect egg quality and how the ovaries work.
So it could result in, like, genetic defects in the
child? No, just difficulty getting pregnant, yeah.
If someone's a surrogate mother and they do something to, like drink a lot of alcohol or do something to lose a pregnancy, are there, like, legal actions taken against that person? Do the donors have to still pay the money?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Daisy?
I just had a quick question about the endometriosis. Is there any treatment for that? Or is there anything they could do do the people who have it, like, in the way such that they have to miss school and work, is there any sort of relief for that?
Yeah, probably the best treatment for it is birth control pills, because what that has a tendency to do is to quiet down the hormones. Typically, endometriosis can be made worse by hormone fluctuations and estrogen in particular. And birth control pills often will give people like a very light period and a much shorter period, and so that makes episodes of pain better. And then basic anti-inflammatory medications, you know, Naprosyn, Motrin, and that type of thing will make it better. Sometimes people need surgery, where we go in and do a laparoscopy, like where you go in through the belly button, and we go and we cauterize, we burn the endometriosis implants, and oftentimes that will make the pain a lot better. And I'm sure people in here have endometriosis and know they have it, but I wouldn't worry about it. I mean, most people have endometriosis, they're going to be fine, and they're going to have the babies, and you know, if they want to, and that type of thing. But there are certain people who will have problems with their tubes or scarring because of it. Any other? So let's go on to egg donation. So using another woman's eggs, why would you want to do that? You might want to do it because you're older and you don't have any eggs left. You might want to do it because you went through premature ovarian failure and you're 30 years old and all your eggs are gone. Maybe you've gone through IVF many times and the egg quality looks bad and the embryos look bad and you're not getting pregnant. You're going to use someone else's eggs. So there are different reasons why. And this little ad here says, we are always searching for exceptional donors. If you are between 19 and 32 years of age, healthy, intelligent, athletic, artistic, musically talented, attractive, or possess other exceptional qualities, you could be a candidate for our program. So the way it works is it's like IVF for two people, basically. One of the women goes through the stimulation of the ovaries and having the eggs grow and having the eggs taken out of her body. And then those eggs are typically put together in the laboratory with the recipient's partner's sperm. And then the eggs are put back into the recipient, okay, the person who's using the eggs. Can you have known donors or anonymous donors? Yeah.
I had a question, like, if you were, like, we were out of eggs and you want to use, like, an egg donor, like, I remember we saw a video where they did, like, nuclear transfer. Like, they took, like, your DNA, so, like, you necessarily had, like, a donated egg, but then they just implanted your DNA into that. You guys do any of that, like, nuclear transfer stuff or no?
We don't. But that's something that's being studied. But it's not something that's really being done beyond that research level. Like I said, most people will pick an anonymous donor. It's interesting, I've been thinking about this recently, when you're choosing an egg donor, you almost always get to see a picture of her. And then you get her medical history and her family history and, you know, her ethnic background and her education and interest and all of these things. And typically people pick a donor who looks like them. You know, same ethnic background, they say hair color, eye color, that type of thing. And most people choose to tell their offspring that someone else's eggs were used, but some people don't want anyone to know. So that's another ethical issue that comes up with this. But with sperm donors, I was thinking about, it's really random and you never see the pictures. People just pick, you know, 6 feet, brown hair, green eyes, you know, that type of thing. But with egg donors, you really get a lot more information. This shows the difference between having children with your own eggs as you age or using someone else's eggs. And the top line is, or the bottom line here, are pregnancy rates as you age. And you can see by the time you're down here in your early 40s, pregnancy rates are very low. But with the egg donor, they basically stay the same throughout a woman's life, the recipients.
I'm just a little curious why it just starts to go back up once you hit past around 44. Is there any reason?
I don't know what that is, and that's crazy. I don't know. That's not true. That's not true. Bad slide. These are just things I pulled out of publications. Grade A, the market for a Yale woman's eggs. When a Yale undergraduate explored becoming an egg donor for a wealthy couple willing to pay top dollar to the right candidate, she didn't realize how unsettling the process of candidacy would prove to be. Or this one from Massachusetts. To the horror and disgust of mainstream infertility groups, a longtime fashion photographer has begun offering up models as egg donors to the highest bidders, auctioning their ova via the internet to would-be parents willing to pay up to $150,000 in hopes of having a beautiful child. So another thing is, how old is too old for a recipient to be? I think the oldest one to date is 63. Okay, 63-year-old woman with a 65-year-old man. And this actually took place at Loma Linda when I was a resident. And I was there for her delivery. And she presented herself as a 53-year-old woman. She looked young, you know, she looked 53. And she went through a donor egg cycle. These two had been together for 30 years, and they decided they want a baby. Now, so they went through it. She had this baby. She had a nice pregnancy, healthy pregnancy delivery. And so then the baby was born to a 63-year-old woman, a 65-year-old man. So, I mean, everybody feels differently about this. Is that okay? Is it that not okay? And so you can look at it just from the standpoint of, will this child have anyone around? And, you know, are the parents too old? That kind of thing. Or you can look at it from the from the standpoint, is this healthy for a woman? And there was a study that was done out of USC looking at 77 recipients of egg donation with a mean age of 53. And 42 had live births, so over 50% of them. And what they found were increased obstetrical complications in this age group, including preeclampsia, which I told you about is that disorder very specific to pregnancy that can be very serious. And instead of 3 to 10%, which is the background incidence of preeclampsia, was 35% in this group. And then the background incidence of gestational diabetes, you know, diabetes in pregnancy, is 5% in this group, was 20%. So you're seeing medical complications occurring in these women. And so how old is too old to be a woman, to be a carry a pregnancy? What do you, does anyone have any opinions? Yeah?
I wouldn't presume to know, like, you know, in terms of a woman's health, how old she could be to carry a pregnancy, but I think just in terms of the quality of life of the child, I'm assuming that, you know, if you're 63, by the time your child is 20, you're going to be 83. Mm-hmm. And having an 83-year-old parent when you're going through puberty, I mean, you know, it's, mm-hmm. it's something to consider for sure. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't do it, but mm-hmm. I'm sure that it's going to cause problems for the child.
Yeah, I'm going to take exception to that.
Well, you know, men have been having children for, you know, they can have children when they're 80 and whatever. And but it's, you know, sometimes people look at it differently. Or now maybe they're saying, well, maybe both of the parents. In that case, maybe it was an 80-year-old man, but it was with a woman who was reproductive age. And so she was probably early 40s or less. And they'll have maybe at least, you know, one parent around when they're 40 or something. So this is a big question, and there's not any sort of national standard or anything on this. These experiments, these research studies that are coming out are helpful to know that, you know, there are complications that occur and that you need to advise people about these. And certain practices, where I used to be at UC San Francisco, the limit was 51. Where I work now, it's up to the physician. Okay, then I'm going to talk about genetic testing. We can do testing before conception. We can do it before an embryo is implanted. That's pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. We can do it during the pregnancy, prenatal, or after the baby's born, postnatal. We offer preconception counseling to all women. The one thing that we like to stress is that every woman should be on prenatal vitamins. Every woman who's having sex should be on prenatal vitamins if you think that you're going to have a baby if you get pregnant. Even if you're not expecting it. And the reason is because there have been studies that have shown that you can decrease the rates of spinal cord defects significantly by having folic acid, 400 micrograms a day. So everyone should be on prenatal vitamins. We test everybody for rubella and varicella. Varicella is chickenpox, to make sure that they're immune, because these are two viruses you do not want to have a fetus exposed to, very severe. We also check a woman's blood type and see if she's positive or negative. Yeah.
What happens when the mother and the baby have different blood types? Or like if one's positive and the baby's negative or
right.
something like that?
So if a woman is negative and the baby is positive, it doesn't matter in a first pregnancy. First pregnancies don't matter. But what happens is that after a first pregnancy, the woman can form antibodies against her baby because now she's been exposed to these to this positive blood type. And so in her next pregnancy, she could actually sensitize her own baby and form antibodies against her own baby. So it's very important to know the blood type. And it's really important to know the blood type even in someone who's like going to have it, who has a miscarriage early, who has an abortion. People need to have something called Rogam, which is an injection that they get to provide them protection in a second pregnancy so that they do not attack their own baby. Okay, if their baby's different. If the woman's negative and the partner's negative, you don't have to worry about it unless she, you know, is pregnant with someone else and you don't know that. So, but it's important that the woman gets Rogam during her pregnancy at 28 weeks and then within 72 hours after delivery to make sure that doesn't happen.
Is this something that could happen in a normal pregnancy or just if you're getting anxious from somebody else?
No, normal pregnancy. Oh. Normal. So anyone who has a negative blood type, if you're O negative or A negative or something like that, it's just important that you know that your physician knows that, and you get appropriate treatment during your pregnancy. If you do, you're fine.
Okay.
and your next pregnancy will be fine. You also test, yeah.
So before, in the past, then they just, during the second pregnancy, I mean, that's a bummer, kind of?
That's right. Particularly, not it's not going to happen to everybody, but particularly to people who are exposed to the baby's blood. So, that usually does happen, I mean, during delivery, is that the mom's going to have some exposure to baby's blood, and their blood's going to mix. And what would happen is, right, the women would have this thing where they would have what's called Rh isoimmunization. Very, very serious if it happens. The baby doesn't grow normally, can become filled with fluid under its skin, have major problems. And sometimes what you need to do in those situations is you need to do blood transfusions into the umbilical cord during the pregnancy. I mean, it can become a really serious thing, and it's really easily taken care of now. Test everybody for HIV and hepatitis. You can pass those things on to your babies. And cystic fibrosis, which is a significant disease that's an autosomal recessive disease that affects the lungs and kidneys and shortens people's lifespans. Typically, people die in their 30s who have cystic fibrosis. And it's the carrier rate for that in the population is 1 in 29. So we test everybody for cystic fibrosis now prior to conception. Certain ethnic groups get further testing offered to them, thalassemia for Mediterranean population, sickle cell anemia screen for African American population. Cystic fibrosis used to just be tested in Caucasian Hispanic population, but now is offered to everybody. And then the Ashkenazi Jewish population can be tested for these 7 autosomal recessive disorders that are common in that group. Then we'll talk about prenatal testing. This is testing that occurs during the pregnancy. And prenatal testing can include ultrasounds, blood tests, chorionic villus sampling, or amniocentesis. Ultrasounds, the newest thing that's come around is something called nuchal translucency screening. Nuchal means neck, and it's an ultrasound that's done between 10 and 13 weeks of pregnancy, and it's a screen for Down syndrome. And what they do on this test is they look, here's the baby's head, you look at the baby in profile, this is a little nose right here, mouth, chin. And this is its neck, and back behind here you'll see 2 lines. And in between there's a little black area, and that's what's called nuchal translucency. And here it's very thin, and it's normal. And here it's thicker, and here it's thicker. And the thicker it gets, the more abnormal it is, and the higher your risk for Down syndrome. So this is a very early test that we can do now, totally non-invasive, to readjust people's risk, to let them know. For example, when I went in and had my last baby, my risk was like 1 in 280 before I had the test. And when I had the test done, then it was 1 in 3,000. So it can be reassuring or it can be scary. And they say, oh gosh, I need an amniocentesis or something because it's very high. And with this, they've actually added in the last 2 years also a measurement of the nasal bone, the nose bone, which makes this even more accurate for detecting Down syndrome. In the second trimester of pregnancy, every woman will be offered a second trimester ultrasound around 18 to 20 weeks of pregnancy, covered by insurance. It's a very detailed exam, specifically looking for disorders like Down syndrome, other trisomies. A trisomy is when you have one extra chromosome, so like 3 chromosome 21s, 3 chromosome 18s. And during this second trimester ultrasound, we look at everything, heart, kidneys, spine, limbs, cleft lips, all of that type of thing. And here's some examples of some abnormalities on that second trimester ultrasound. This is a baby's belly right here, and these little bright areas, you're not supposed to have bright stuff in your belly, and that's called echogenic bowel, and that's associated with Down syndrome. These are kidneys, and they're filled with cysts, and there's something that's called polycystic kidney disease, which I think is, I want to say, autosomal dominant disorder. This is a baby's head, and this baby has a cyst inside of its head, choroid plexus cyst inside its brain. This baby here has 6 fingers. It's a little hand instead of 5. And this is a baby, this is its head, this is its body, and its spine. And this big thing right here is called a cystic hygroma, and that's a huge mass behind its neck, growing kind of that grows out of the side of your neck. Okay, so we have ultrasounds done. Women, when they're pregnant, also have blood tests that are covered by insurance, offered to everybody between 15 and 20 weeks of gestation. The test we do now is called a quad screen, used to be called a triple screen, but now they've added inhibin A. And we look at these 4 things that are listed here, and you can readjust a woman's risk for neural tube defects, which are defects in the spine, Down syndrome, trisomy 18, and abdominal wall defects. Now, who's offered further testing? Women who are of advanced maternal age are going to be offered either a chorionic villus sampling test or an amniocentesis. In advanced, how old do you think advanced maternal age is? 30, 40s, 38, 35, actually. So if you're going to be 35 when you deliver your baby, you're advanced maternal age. And so they're offered, all women of that age are offered further testing. If you've had a previous child or a pregnancy with a birth defect, if you have suggestive screening test results, like your quad screen or your nuchal translucency screen or ultrasound were abnormal, or if you have a family history of some genetic disorder. So one of the tests that we can do is chorionic villus sampling.
Can you ask a question?
Yeah.
I was just wondering, this is, okay, if there are birth defects, or if there are defects that are detected and they do the screening and stuff, up until how late is a woman allowed to terminate a pregnancy?
In California, 24 weeks.
Okay, and at what point do these tests get done?
So nuchal translucency screening, like I said, was 10 to 13 weeks. Chorionic villus sampling, which is a definitive test where you actually look at chromosomes, is done between 11 and 13 weeks of pregnancy. Typically takes about 2 to 3 weeks to get results back. So usually by the time you're 16 weeks at the most, you're going to know.
You know
how the baby's doing. You know if it has an extra chromosome down, something. And then amniocentesis, which most people choose amniocentesis over CVS. You don't have that done till about 18 weeks of pregnancy. You don't typically know till about over 20 weeks of pregnancy. It gets really tight. Yeah.
When you say that these tests are offered, does that mean they offer like by insurance, or they're optional, or they're suggested, or what does that mean?
The tests that are going to be covered by insurance includes the quad screen, the blood test I told you about, and the 18 to 20 week ultrasound. Those are offered and insurance covered to patients. If there are abnormalities there, then these further tests should be covered by insurance, or if a woman is of advanced maternal age or has the history. If she just wants to do it, it's probably not covered. Yeah.
That's what you meant by offered?
Yes. Yeah. Heather?
What would trisomy of the 18th chromosome cause?
It's awful. It causes lots of abnormalities, heart abnormalities, kidney abnormalities, very significant abnormalities in the face with low set ears, cleft lips. The babies look totally abnormal when they come out, and they do not live. I mean, they can live a short period of time, and then they die. So, yeah.
When is the earliest that a fetus can be aborted, and when's the latest?
So the cutoff, the latest cutoff is 24 weeks, like we have. And the earliest is, cutoff is 20. And I think there are some states that don't allow it. Is that right?
First trimester. Always.
Just first, yeah. Any other? So chorionic villus sampling happens between 11 to 13 weeks of pregnancy. We take a catheter that has a needle in it, place it either through the cervix or abdomen and into where the pregnancy is, and you take cells off the placenta. And then you test those cells for chromosome and gene defects in the lab. It takes about 2 to 3 weeks to get the results, and the miscarriage rate with this procedure is 1 to 2%. This used to be done earlier, but they found that that chorionic villus sampling done at 10 weeks or earlier actually caused limb deficiencies, arms and legs and fingers, probably from the needle. So that's why they're done later now. You can do amniocentesis. That's typically performed between 15 and 18 weeks of pregnancy, up to 20 weeks of pregnancy. Needle is placed through the abdominal wall into the amniotic sac, and then 10 cc's of amniotic fluid are drawn out. There are living cells from the fetus that are in the amniotic fluid, and then those are grown in the lab in 1 to 2 weeks. You get your results back in about 3 weeks. And again, that tests for chromosome and gene defects. And then we can do testing on babies after they're born. And when I gave this talk last year, I had these California mandated tests on there, and there were just those 5 tests that were there with those first 4 bullets. And now, as of July 2005, a bunch of other tests have been added, and they're mandatory in the state of California. This testing is done typically during the first day of life, and they take the baby and they stick a needle into its heel and push the blood out and run these tests, and these are some of the tests that can be done now. And it's, I mean, this has become available because of advances in this tandem mass spectrometry. So then the newest kind of testing you can do is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and this has only come about because of in vitro fertilization and the ability to, you know, really look at these embryos. And this can test embryos for genetic abnormalities prior to implantation. And with PGD, we use a single cell at the 8-cell stage. Remember the embryo I showed you that had 8 cells? What we would do is just take one cell off at that stage and test it. So you can see all these embryos. You can't tell by looking at them. If they look good or look bad, you can't tell which one is disease-free. So at the 8-cell stage, you go and you take off a single cell. And the things you can test for are single gene defects, balanced translocations. These are the people who might need PGD are people with a history of single gene defects in the family, balanced translocations. Women of advanced maternal age may decide to do this because there are increased risks of aneuploidy, and aneuploidy is just when you have an abnormal number of chromosomes. Maybe you have just one of a chromosome instead of two, or maybe you have three, so it's just an abnormal number. People who had repetitive IVF failures sometimes will have their embryos tested to see, are they normal? You know, are any of them normal, or maybe they're all abnormal. People who have recurrent miscarriages, and so this is what we can do to select embryos, healthy embryos, to put back. PGD, the way we test for chromosome abnormalities is with fluorescence in situ hybridization, or FISH. So there you can look at abnormal chromosome numbers, translocations, and you can discover the sex of the embryos, if they're male or female. And usually when we do PGD screening for chromosomes, we look for the most common 5 to 9 most common chromosome abnormalities. And we can use PCR to look for specific single gene disorders. And these are some of the chromosome abnormalities and single gene disorders that we're able to test for with PGD. Thanks. So why would somebody choose to do PGD for a single gene disorder? One is that it's safer than going under and having a elective termination. For some couples, it's more psychologically acceptable. And it can provide couples who would not terminate a pregnancy with more options besides adoption or using someone else's eggs or sperm. This is the way that it works. So this is the 8-cell embryo on day 3. After a cycle of in vitro, a biopsy of a single cell can be performed from the 8-cell embryo obtained after 3 days of culture in the lab. And here you can see pulling off one cell right here. Time the biopsy at less than 67 hours after retrieval, because when they were done later than that, we had decreased implantation rates. And you can see here that the cell is now being pulled off. It's right here inside the little pipette. This is the cell. Genetic material of the single cell can be amplified by PCR, and the chromosomal mutation, a chromosomal mutation or an aneuploidy can be identified in the embryo. And then the embryo would continue to grow for 2 more days in the lab, awaiting your genetic analysis and confirmation of which embryos were unaffected by the disorder that you're looking for. And then unaffected embryos are transferred to the uterus at the blastocyst stage, which is day 5 of embryo development. And then subsequently, a child would be born unaffected from the screened genetic disease. Here's an example of looking for the sex of the chromosome. Using FISH, you can see that this is a girl. There's 2 X chromosomes. So this might be important in a family that's got sex-linked disease such as hemophilia, or people use this for family balancing. And here's a male embryo with an X and a Y chromosome. We can compare prenatal and pre-implantation diagnosis. So prenatal would be something like amniocentesis, and pre-implantation is PGD. You need greater than 100,000 cells to do amniocentesis. You need one cell for PGD. It takes about 2 weeks to get your results back from amnio. It takes 6 to 10 hours with PGD. They're both very accurate, but typically the amniocentesis is covered if a woman needs it, and you have to pay for your PGD. So people that would benefit from PGD, couples with a history of abnormal numbers of chromosomes, single gene disorders, balanced translocation, or couples who desire an offspring of a specific sex. And then there are a lot of things that might, we talked about, someone brought up cytoplasmic transfer. That's something that's being looked at in the research lab, or maybe reproducing without gametes and making gametes or synthesizing them. The biggest thing right now is the egg freezing that I talked about, where you can actually sort of pause the biological clock. And egg freezing is important for people, like I said, maybe people who have cancer and have chances of the eggs being destroyed. People who have a history in their family of premature ovarian failure or that early menopause, they may want to have eggs removed early. Or someone who is in their mid to late 30s who thinks they just want to preserve the eggs and they're not ready to have a baby yet, maybe haven't found the right person to have a baby with. And then I'm going to talk about some cases. We're almost done. It's the last thing. I'm going to tell you about some real cases. Most of the cases are actually things that people that I have seen or that my colleagues have seen, and then the last two are from the media, but actual cases. And I'm just going to see what you think about this. If you were a reproductive endocrinologist, and would you do this, or do you think it's okay? Would you refer the patient maybe to another physician? So first case is this sperm donor case. I had a couple come in, 57-year-old man, 37-year-old woman. He had been married previously, had 3 grown children, and he remarried, 37-year-old woman, and he'd had a vasectomy. He had his vasectomy reversed because they wanted to have a child of their own, but it didn't work. So it was an unsuccessful vasectomy reversal. Gave him the option of going in and getting the sperm from the test. Well, he didn't want to do that. And he wanted to use his son's sperm. So he wanted his son to be a sperm donor for him and his new wife. So do you have any opinions about that, or would you do it? Is it okay? Who's the dad? Who's the brother?
Speak for some people that we haven't heard from before. Turn your mic on.
I think that as long as there weren't any biological complications based on, you know, the biological relationship between the father and son, I guess that maybe it would be a personal choice, as weird as that was. Although, you know, I would advise them to take the psychological consequences for the child into mind very strongly. And I don't think I would personally do it. I'd probably refer them to a different physician.
Okay. Any other opinions about that?
I think it would be weird for both the child, like the grown child and the new child, because they would have a very weird relationship. Mm-hmm. You'd be like, is he my brother or is he my dad? Or,
right.
And I think, like, just mentally.
And is he my dad or my grandpa? Or
yeah.
Right.
And just mentally, like, growing up and knowing that, because I think the kid should know if it does happen. Right. It would just be really weird for him or her growing up.
Right. Do you think people should let their children know if they use a donor gamete, or do you think it's okay just to say you are, you know, just let everybody think that it's your genetic baby?
Good question. I think it would really, be a personal call for them. It's just, you know, I would probably want a kid to know, but I think for an individual family, I think that would, yeah, I'd say it's really sort of a personal call from them.
Okay. Do you know? Okay.
In answer to that question, I kind of feel like, I'm not sure how this would work exactly, but if they, for example, used a donor sperm or egg, and you have, or that person's family has certain genetic diseases or in their family history, I think you probably have to let the child know.
Right. And that's what's happened, actually. There have been cases like that where they've decided not to let them know, and then they have to let them know at a much later age. So the suggestion is, from psychologists at least, that children should know, and they should know in an age-appropriate fashion, and we should probably start to tell children between the ages of 5 and 8 years of age initially, bring out that concept in a very simple way to them. There are a lot of books out there that I was born by ART, Advanced Reproductive Technology, and, you know, my parents wanted me so much, you know, that there are a lot of books like that and that are very sort of age-appropriate, and the suggestion is, at least from the psychologists and psychiatrists, that we should let them know. Okay, another case, a lesbian couple that came in, they'd been together for 5 years, they wanted to start a family. The younger woman was 28 years old, she was a student, she was very busy. The older person in the couple is 36 years old. What they wanted to do was to harvest the eggs from the 28-year-old, put them together with donor sperm, and then place the embryos back into the 36-year-old. Into her uterus. And in this way, the couple could have
one of the parents could have a genetic bond to the child, and the other could have a gestational bond from carrying the child and breastfeeding, etc.
Let's hear from some other people. Matthias, what do you think?
I think that that as far as, you know, that's their choice, you know, I think they should be allowed to do just so. It's just like having a surrogate mother in this case, and they will both have the connection to the child, mm-hmm. and they'll be able to keep, raise them efficiently, mm-hmm. I assume.
Okay.
Patricia, what do you think?
I think that the I also
think it's their choice.
Can you
mic on? It's on. I also think it's their choice. Couldn't you as well do, like, have both of their, take eggs from both of them and then, like, switch off?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of?
Mm-hmm.
And that way they both.
You could.
Yeah, kind of getting nervous.
Right. Right.
Both of them would
you could
have
do
pregnancies,
it. You could
right?
do it the opposite
yeah.
if you want to, or you could even take eggs from both and you could put them all together and you wouldn't know what baby.
No,
was
mean,
born. There's all sorts of ways you could do it. But yes, they could switch off. So that,
right, or
mm-hmm.
they can have two babies as well.
Right. Right, exactly. Yeah, and both could carry. I see what you mean. Okay, so this case was really an interesting case. A 30-year-old woman and her husband came in, and she had a family history of Huntington's disease. And Huntington's disease is an autosomal dominant disease, very significant neurologic defects, but the things that doesn't occur until your 40s. So you don't know, you don't have any signs or symptoms of this until you're in your 40s, and then you have quick degeneration. People typically die early. So this woman had this family history. She was 30. She did not want to know if she had Huntington's disease, but they wanted to have a pregnancy, and she wanted only unaffected embryos placed back in her uterus. So this was what was called a full non-disclosure case. So you couldn't tell them anything. So basically, you didn't want to tell them how many eggs they were. You're doing really well. Because you typically say, oh, you're making so many eggs, and it looks great. Can't tell them anything. Because if they're making so many eggs, and all of a sudden they only have one embryo, they probably know that they have Huntington's disease. So nothing was said, no ultrasounds. They couldn't look at anything. You didn't say anything. Just, you know, walk out and nothing. And then they just wanted to have healthy embryos placed back. So she still wasn't going to know and did have healthy embryos placed back inside. But again, she's not going to know 10 years from now if she's going to have this very significant disorder where she's not going to be able to care for her children. Any thoughts on that?
What do you think, Sharon?
I think it's her choice. I don't think it's the right of the doctor to say you have Huntington's disease. Mm-hmm. It's her life choice if she wants to have children, knowing whether or not she can raise them. I mean, it's not. It's a very private choice. So
right.
I don't think that. I mean, I think that the doctor should just do their job and let her decide.
Do you think in all cases a doctor should just do their job and everybody should be able to decide what they want for themselves?
Well, unless the doctor wants to take the responsibility, if the doctor told her that she was going to have Huntington's disease and then she regretted that, that information, the doctor has to, you know, it's just too much. The doctor gets involved and then it's too complicated, I think. So, I mean, it's a personal choice for the doctor, too, whether or not.
They want to do it, right.
Matt?
Yeah, just curious. Did you say that Huntington's disease ran in her family at all?
It did.
Okay, it did.
It did. So she had a 50% chance of having it.
So then in that situation, I think it's the fair way to go. That way you're protecting her privacy, which would be the situation if she conceived the normal way, and you're also protecting the health, future health of the child. So it seems like an ethical approach. And then I also wanted to comment on the second
mm-hmm.
female couple that
mm-hmm.
you discussed. Following that route, like, I know that lesbian parents will sometimes adopt, and then you've got the situation where your adopted parents, not real parents, this way, you're sort of, in a way, both parents of the child, and psychologically for the child, it almost seems like it might be a healthier
more
approach
of a bond.
To take.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, this was interesting with this the couple with the Huntington's disease. These two were very dedicated to this process, went through all sorts of testing prior to doing the psychological testing, et cetera, prior to doing this. And as soon as she was pregnant, he wanted her to have an abortion. And she didn't, and he left her. So I think it's really interesting, and I wondered about that. And then we had another couple that did the same thing. When as soon as she was pregnant, same Huntington's disease situation, he wanted her to terminate. She did terminate in the second case. And it brought up to me the fact that maybe this was not a reality for this spouse. What did this mean? What if his wife really did have Huntington's disease, and now they're pregnant? And what if she's not around in 50, and he's raising the baby by himself? I don't really know what happened, but in two cases, something very similar happened in that situation. There's lots of cases where it hasn't happened, but I just thought it was interesting. Let's see. Okay. Well, how about family balancing? Had a couple come in that were from India. They had four girls. The woman was 42 years old. The man was 51 years old. Their youngest daughter was 10 years old. They wanted a boy. They'd had an abortion 5 years ago of a female infant when they found out that the baby was female. So they actually aborted it. They had been unable to achieve a pregnancy since this pregnancy 5 years ago that they aborted. Now they came in and they wanted to do IVF and PGD to have a boy. Yeah.
Let's hear from Samantha.
I think that the PGD is more acceptable than just aborting female fetuses. And I'd say that because maybe if like they had four girls, it would be okay. But if this was their first child, it wouldn't be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just be up to the doctor. The doctor didn't feel comfortable. The doctor should say, I don't want to do this procedure.
Okay.
What do you think, T?
What do I think of this situation? Like, what would they do? Or
do you think that's okay for them? Would you do it? Like, if you're a reproductive endocrinologist, maybe, do you think it's okay? Would you do it? Would you pass it on to somebody else?
Me personally, I wouldn't do it because it's just, I don't know, it's not fair. Like, it's kind of sexist in a way, I think so. I don't know. Or, like, but it's up to them. Like, it's not like I'm going to pass judge or just did. But
everyone feels a way that's the good thing about this specialty is if you don't feel comfortable doing something, as long as you can refer them to somebody else, okay, you don't have to do it.
Yeah. So
and now this is what came next, though. We did a workup and found out that the woman actually did not have very many eggs left. Her FSH level was high, meaning that she had a very low chance of having a pregnancy. She was perimenopausal. So the suggestion was that they should use an egg donor. And when it came down to that, they decided, like I said, the couple, they were from India. They both had dark hair, dark eyes. And they wanted a blonde, blue-eyed donor. So it's sort of, I don't know. They said that would be really pretty, maybe, to have this combination of, my dark features and the blonde. And
that kind of reminds me of, like, we saw an advertisement from the Daily Bruin,
mm-hmm.
about, like, how, you want an egg donor that has this certain SAT score and
right.
this certain, and I wouldn't do it either.
Mm-hmm.
It's just similar to that model egg thing, too.
Right.
It's like, so.
Okay.
I wouldn't do that either.
Stop.
About the wrongful death?
Oh, this was a case out of from Illinois where embryos were dropped on the ground.
Whoops.
And so the couple sued for wrongful death. Sued the physician.
What do you think about that? Matt?
It was right that they didn't win because they could. I mean, there's any. I mean, some circumstance could have happened, and even though the doctor may have taken all the precautions necessary, I think. I mean, you can't. you can't blame them for that. I mean, I think maybe they should be compensated in some way, but I don't think they should be. The doctor should be, personally.
So there's human error, I mean, in any of these things, right? There are going to be complications that can occur and mistakes that are made because it's human beings doing the procedures.
I just want to talk. Comment that with the wrongful death situation,
yeah.
You're producing all these embryos, and if you're going to throw out leftover embryos when you're finished, then you'd be in a way committing wrongful death as well if you're suing the doctor for wrongful death in that situation. So I think ethically, it's not really sound.
Any other questions for Dr. Evans? Chris?
So kind of a two-stage question. We read recently in a paper assigned for this class that as a result of the lack of legal regulations on IVF, so that they're finding out that some of the IVF babies are at greater medical risk on some unspecified things, right? But we're finding out now 25 years later that there are some risks.
There are some risks, and there have been some increase in congenital anomalies in babies born from IVF, and specifically, they think there may be some imprinting disorders, which is really complex in the way that it works, and it's shutting off and turning on certain genetic material from the mom and the dad. And so there's actually been very big committees that have been formed through the American Society of Reproductive Medicine to look at this, and these committees include pediatricians, geneticists, reproductive endocrinologists, ethicists, et cetera, to look at this and to look and see if there is a basis to this, if this has to do with the IVF process itself, if it has to do, there's always questions of, does this have to do with infertility, just the fact that you're infertile, is there something inherent to that that's causing these problems? There have been some sex chromosome abnormalities seen in babies born with ICSI as well. And there is a belief, which I mean I think is very true, is that the ICSI that we're doing for people who have really abnormal sperm, it's probably because they've got problems with their Y chromosome and microdeletions and things in their Y chromosome, and then they're probably going to pass it on to their male offspring who are then going to need ICSI.
And so does this have a sufficiently wide empirical basis that you would buy as clients of these things?
Yes.
As this comes up?
Yes.
Okay. And so the second stage was, as a result of this, there's been this lack of legal regulations. So in your experience, have you felt it? Have you wished for more guidelines at any point? Have you felt like, in your personal experience, you would wish there was something to defer to in some of these situations? Or
yeah.
Do you feel comfortable with the passing the buck situation?
No, I think it would be really great to have a very detailed registry. I mean, we do have a registry of sort of statistics through the Society of American Reproductive Technology, SART, where we put in, you know, how many embryos are transferred and how many multiple pregnancies and this type of thing. We have that type of detail, but we don't have these really detailed registries about specific outcomes, and I think it's important for us to have that, you know, worldwide, where we can look at the data from all the countries and put everything together and really have good outcome data, which we don't have. I think it's important.
Any other questions? One, because you'll have a chance in a couple minutes to ask Dr. Evans as many questions as you want. And those of you who are going to dinner will have a chance again. Any other questions? If not, really, let's thank Dr. Evans for all.
Thank you.
Considering that her son was sick yesterday and she didn't get any sleep and was up all night, it's pretty incredible. So why don't we just leave some stuff here and go outside and have some food. Mike and Jessica are going to take care of Dr. Evans. And go out and have some food. And Gloria, you're going to help too, I assume.
I'm so glad that's over.